Tonight on The Download, Pitchfork Media President Chris Caskey, architecture contributor Lee Bay, and live music in Studio 435 with White Mystery. Now here's your host, a man who bought up all the rainbow flags at half price today, Justin Kaufman.
I just go to the Gay Pride store, get everything I possibly can for $25, and sell it for triple. Hey, you know, that's how I celebrate Pride. No, I didn't do that. Come on, Pete. What a fun day yesterday. This is a download here on WGN Radio. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. I'm Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN. Yes, great. I had a great time yesterday at the parade. Thanks to everyone in the WGN family and to the city and everyone who puts the parade on, the parade folks. It was a great time. And I've never walked in a parade before. I know that sounds stupid for a guy in radio media. It feels like every time you go to a parade, you see people are like, oh, it's the guys from, oh, yeah, I don't listen to that show. I always feel bad. You know, I will say this. Whenever I'm watching a parade, I'm always like, I don't care. All right, next. And I will give Jackie Paulus here at WGN extreme credit, because what she did, which is such a great thing, is she was able to hire the drum group. I forgot their name, and I should know their name. The drum corps that was on the WGN radio float. And so it was an experience when our float came through. You know, like, if we didn't have that, if we were just walking along the route,
mm-hmm.
and I got rid of my beads in the first, you know, before Montrose.
I know.
I would have been, like, embarrassed, because people have been like, all right, what's next? But because, like, you were standing there and you'd wave and they go, oh, because here comes your float with the drums and
yeah.
the beats and the party and dancing. It was great. So I give it a lot of credit.
Yeah.
That's how you do it. It was a fun time. It was good to be. You had a good time?
I had a wonderful time.
I don't know if we can coax. Maybe if we try hard, we can coax the after party stories out of Pete Zimmerman. We'll have to see if that happens. Coming up tonight, Chris Caskey is my guest in the big table. He's the president of Pitchfork, Pitchfork Media. That's both the site and the festival, with festival which is coming up here in July. He's also behind one of the most I would say influential music sites that's going right now. Used to be an industry that was dominated by Rolling Stone and Spin Magazine, those kind of places. Pitchfork came in and usurped that, and they are now on top. Chicago Startup, we'll talk with Chris Caskey about that and their career covering the music industry. Also tonight, Lee Bay will be here. We'll unpack what went wrong with the Lucas Museum. If you know, Lee was part of the group that established and sort of chose that site. I think he was on the commission for the city of Chicago, so we'll talk with Lee. And coming up, White Mystery. How great is that? White Mystery is a great band. In studio, Studio 435 tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Bob Kessler. We'll get to Bob in a little bit. Introduce. He needs no introduction. It's great to work with him. How great is that? Esmeralda Leon, of course. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right, let's take a break. We'll get back to the carryout. Stay with us. All right, coming up after the news, we're going to have Touche. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy are here to argue about polls. We'll talk about that. But first, here's the carryout. Of course, our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The Supreme Court ruled that restrictions on abortion in the state of Texas were too much. It's the first time the court has ruled on the abortion issue in over a decade. Critics are upset, saying the court should stay out of the state's business. Whereas women are like, yeah, stay out of the state's business. That's what we should be doing. Hillary Clinton campaigned in Ohio with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, causing Democrats everywhere to fan themselves. It's so hot in here. So much periwinkle up on that stage. They spent about an hour on stage together, and then Clinton took off for Chicago, where we didn't get Elizabeth Warren. We got Michelle Williams from Destiny's Child. That's the short one, right? All right, we'll take it. Yeah, I like Destiny's Child. I'm impressed. Still some market fallout surrounding the big Brexit move at the end of last week. The good news for the U.S. consumer, this is the time to book a trip to the U.K. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Download Road Trip. Let's plan a weekend to go and buy all the Walker shortbread we can and see where Morrissey lives. That and a tour of all the London EDM clubs. No, not BDM clubs, EDM. I know it's BDSM, but we're not doing any of the S stuff. Speaking of markets, the junk bond market's heating up. The city wants to buy the CBS debt because, you know, that's how money works. You just keep moving debt around till you die. So the city has a better rating than its schools. So to help out the schools, the city wants to take on the debt. It's kind of like when you pull a hammy on one leg and then the other leg starts to hurt because you changed the way you walk. Yeah, that's Chicago. Purdue Chicken has announced it will drastically change the way it raises its animals. When asked for more specifics, Purdue was like, the chickens are going to go stay with their grandparents? A new nature study says that just like humans, chimpanzees lose friends when they get older. But do chimps unfriend on social media? Do they get mad at their friend for not saying happy birthday enough? Forget evolution. The true difference between our species, social media etiquette. In weather, what a hot weekend. So hot today. Hot again. Tomorrow, not so hot. In sports, the Cubs lost 3 of 4 this weekend from the Miami Marlins. Who? Too much Crockett, not enough Tubbs. No matter, the Cubs are still 9 up in the NL Central, but the San Francisco Giants have been on a tear, and they're only one game behind the Cubs for the best record in the NL, which means nothing in June, but I thought I'd tell you. Also, right now, with about a week to go, the Cubs have their entire infield leading All-Star voting. Yep, so you can see an NL All-Star team that has Bryant, Russell, Zobrist, and Rizzo backing up Jake Arrieta on the mound. Wow, that's kind of boring. What, couldn't vote for one Padre? We're just looking for one Padre. Arrieta goes tonight against Cincy. On the South side, the one-man wrecking crew continued yesterday as Chris Sale won his 13th game of the year. He's got 13 wins already. He's looking down the barrel of 15 by the All-Star break, and of course, the starting nod in that game. Wow, that's going to be something going against all those Cubs. Quietly, the Sox won 2 of 3 from the Blue Jays, although blowing that one loss late on Saturday. Still, 7 games back to the Indians. Come on. New Bulls rookie Denzel Valentine took no time to turn heads at the UC by choosing number 45 as his jersey. Number 45, of course, was the number Jordan used when he returned from retirement. It's considered an unlucky number with Bulls fans, but then again, no, it's not. I've never heard that. If that kid plays anything remotely close to the Jordan who came back, I'll take it. I mean, I know Jordan was rusty, but he still put like 50 up against the Knicks, right? I don't see Etuan Moore putting 50 up against the Knicks. Also, Jimmy Butler was named to the U.S. Olympic team, so have no fear, Chicago Bulls fans. Jimmy will be playing all summer long. So we'll remember that when it's Christmas and he's like, I don't know, my legs, they're just tired. Need a couple days with my cool suit on the bench. And finally tonight, a new study says that Naperville is the safest city in the country to raise children. So that's where Purdue is going to move their chickens. That's the carryout for Monday, June 27th. I threw a couple wet naps in the bag for you just because you look like a sloppy eater. No offense. More to come tonight. We're going to give you a little touche with Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. We'll talk about polls, Trump and Clinton, and how both candidates responded to Brexit. We know how Trump did, but was Hillary Clinton's response sufficient? We'll do all that on the download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right, you go right, you go left, you go right, you go right, you go right, you go left, you go right.
It's Touché time here on the download on 720 WGN Radio. In studio with me, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy, and they are prepared to argue about politics. That's what this is all about, guys. We decided instead of having sort of sustained discourse throughout the week, we would punch it into one Monday segment and let you guys just tear at it about all of the news that you've been simmering over.
We are ready. We are so
really,
in the mood to really touche
cute little
tonight.
Dogs going by outside.
Woof.
There we go. I like the dog.
Good start. Good start to the focus.
Or as they said in the candidate.
Oh, I see. So we're going to get.
They said in the candidate, but how do you like my dog? You remember that line? That was one of the greatest lines in that movie. But. How do you like my dog?
All right, so
and Redford says it's a nice dog.
All right, let's get right to it. The big news, we didn't get a chance to talk to, it was Friday, was the what happened in the UK taken off from the European Union, and let's talk about American politics. Donald Trump was there in Scotland, put foot in mouth, continued to show what kind of. Presidential candidate he is after every big news item. Where
I think
he
it was on
kinda...
the 14th hole he put his foot in his mouth. And I didn't realize that press conference he had was actually from the 14th hole. I'm like, can you demonstrate greater lack of interest in what's going on in the world and a greater lack of seriousness than having a press conference from the 14th hole while you're...
Was he playing?
No.
That would even be better. No, like, let me talk to the press.
Playing.
It was like great Caddyshack, right? No.
He was not playing. No, it would be better, I think, if you were Hillary Clinton and you had badgered everybody in Europe to badgered everybody in the UK to stay in, or Barack Obama and you went over and threatened people
yes,
to stay in.
Every one of the millions of citizens were badgered.
And you ended up on the wrong side of the issue. That's why David wants to draw attention to you know, Donald Trump being a successful businessman and going to one of his new developments.
Well, this
Chris, you're giving me serious confusion. You're for Trump. You're against Trump. You're for Trump. You're against Trump. Dude, pick a lane. Where are you coming down?
Anti-Hillary.
That's a good lane. That's an express lane at this point. All right, so let's talk about this because there was obviously the news. Started off, it felt like that night, it started off that this was a loss for Barack Obama and for Hillary Clinton and for Democrats who wanted the UK to stay in the EU. It turned into, look, once again, the Republican candidate has put his foot in his mouth and how fun this is on social media to watch him stumble and fall. What is the what were the ramifications on both sides with the Brexit?
Honestly, I don't think there's very much ramification from a political standpoint in the United States. Other than it reinforces the meme that Trump is not ready for prime time. I think that there's a larger issue, though, here, and that is the morning after the vote, all of a sudden, millions of people in the UK were having like a hangover. They woke up going like, I did what last night? There are 4 million signatures on a petition to have a revote. There are people who were interviewed who were saying things like, oh, man, I voted for leave, but now I wish I hadn't. And the number one search on Google was, what is the EU? It's like, guys, the time to do that is before. And to me, there is a direct comparison to what's going on in the United States. The hangover people would have if they voted for Trump.
Oh, God. Talk about stretching. Okay. I want to be, you know, I'm going to own up to my age and say I remember distinctly 1979 when Margaret Thatcher won over all of the expectation that she would fall flat on her face. And, you know, she was not the darling of the media elite. She was a, you know, chemist, a female, a self-made person. And, of course, the entire New York Times, Boston, Washington corridor was aligned against her and said she would lose. And she won. And that presaged a certain sentiment. I mean, you come out of California in 78 with the Prop 13 and then to Margaret Thatcher in London and then to Ronald Reagan in 1980. In the same way, David, who represents the party of government, right? And government is going to solve this and government's going to do that. And we have to have more taxes for more government and more government will solve the problems. The government side of the equation profoundly lost in the Brexit vote. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to pick up every issue from the UK and it's going to resonate here in the United States. But in general, it's evocative of a feeling that things are out of control. Things are going in the wrong direction. You know, we got a right direction, wrong track split in this country that is decidedly against the Democrats and against the party of government. And that's exactly what you saw given voice to in the Brexit vote.
Dave?
Well, Chris is right. There are some common strains there. There's also a common strain of xenophobia. You can't. I have heard Chris, and I agree that there are issues with, you know, the UK being controlled by Brussels. But there also is the whole anti-immigrant fervor that was taking place over there. What's fascinating is that if you compare the Bernie voters and the Brexit voters, they're completely opposite. The young people in the UK voted overwhelmingly to stay in the European Union because they're sitting there going like, "Hey, I have a choice at 27
That's
countries."
That's the 24 who voted.
Oh, okay. Well, 65% of those 24, which would be, I think, about 18, actually voted to remain. But what's interesting is that, you know, Chris loves to talk about how, oh, this is a great thing because they stood up against the bureaucrats and Brussels and the lack of representative government and so on. That's fine. But now what? Because what looks like it's going to happen is that the entire UK is going to disintegrate as well as aspects of Europe. And I think that what happened is that in Europe, people took 60 years of stability for granted. And now they're waking up having done this thing with the markets tanking. The Dow lost another 300 points today. That's 900 in 2 days. Global markets are panicking, going like, what's going to happen? Frankly, for the U.S. economy, it's probably not going to mean very much.
Right. They're not panicking. They're correcting. And they're correcting because, and I hate to say this because it shouldn't happen, but a lot of the investors go by mainstream media reporting and they had no sense. Everybody who I think was serious about watching the evolution of opinion in the United Kingdom was very well versed in the likelihood, not the possibility, but the likelihood that Leave would win. The investors, for a variety of reasons, and I think that's an interesting conversation in itself, which we won't get into tonight, investors got on the wrong side of that, and that's why they're correcting. But I agree with David that the unraveling of these big government structures, okay, is not easy. And there is unraveling, and there is going to be a bit of a mess in terms of unraveling this. But the UK was turned down. David Cameron himself personally, and we're way out of what American voters care about, but since we're here, David Cameron went to the EU in February and said, I have got to do this referendum. Give me some concessions. Make your activity responsible to the folks in my country who are getting derogation after derogation established against EU policies. The EU told him, no soap, go back to London, win your referendum, and just sit down and be quiet. We'll tell you what your opinion is.
Yeah, that was a big oops. David Cameron made just a catastrophic political miscalculation and assumed that...
The miscalculation was on the part of the EU. Cameron was doing the right thing. He understood the sentiment was against
the
EU.
Political
and he went there and he said, you got to do something or you're going to lose. And they said, you're out of your mind. Go home and win the vote.
Fine. And it was the greatest political miscalculation calling for that referendum since the George W. Bush advocated for a vote in Gaza.
The guy would not have been prime minister at all. It was a very reasonable calculation because the Eurosceptic wing of the Conservative Party, which was joined, by the way, by the rank and file of the Labour Party in many voting districts throughout the country. It's a very interesting, non-traditional splitting up of the electorate. And that's another thing that's got to be watched very carefully relative to the evolution of November.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, we'll pick it up here on the second half, the other side of the break here. We'll continue.
Welcome
Touché.
To Masterpiece
we're
Radio.
We're going to get past Brexit here, and we're going to get a little closer to home. All right, stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what you said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
It's the download here on 720 WGN Chicago. I'm Justin Kaufman. Touché. We're doing a little touché with Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling.
I'm all right.
Hello, Chris. I don't think so.
as we're doing.
We're still stuck in masterpiece radio.
No, UK politics.
You don't want to sound like public radio. That's bad.
No, no, no.
We're not going there.
No.
Okay, Chris. We won't bother with that.
We won't. All right, let's make a move here. Today we saw Hillary Clinton in Chicago. But before that, we saw her in Ohio with a big rally with Senator Elizabeth Warren, piquing interest. And, you know, I forgot what I was reading, Washington Post or whoever, saying she's being vetted as a vice presidential candidate. I mean, what's the thought on the Democratic side of the aisle of Clinton and Warren being on the same side together, on the same stage?
Well, there are some folks who think that that's a fabulous idea. Many of them are on the Republican side of the aisle. because right now, Wall Street, just let's take Wall Street money. Wall Street money right now is staying away from Donald Trump in droves. You put Elizabeth Warren on the Democratic ticket, suddenly you've united Wall Street and Donald Trump in an interesting unholy alliance. Look, I watched the speech today in Ohio, or parts of the thing, and there's no doubt the dynamism, the energy, the excitement. Hillary Clinton has not seen crowds like that in this entire campaign. I mean, there was a buzz in the room, no doubt about it. And Elizabeth Warren can slice and dice Donald Trump like nobody's business, and clearly Hillary was enjoying it. That's not the same thing as saying I want this person to be my running mate and we'll do this for the next 4 or 8 years. I tend to doubt it. I think she does what, frankly, her husband did. She doubles down on her competitive advantage, which is stability and strength and experience, and she goes with somebody like Tim Kaine. I didn't like that idea at first because he's, frankly, really boring.
But he's the nicest guy in the world.
But don't you run the risk? I mean, don't you run the risk of being almost the opposite of a rock and roll sort of Barack Obama thing, and where Democrats, especially young Democrats, aren't interested in the Hillary Clinton, Tim Kaine ticket? I mean, doesn't Elizabeth Warren sort of get that Bernie Sanders vote out, that millennial that really is?
What about that?
She does, but then you got to govern, and I think that there's a real question. Look, I like listening to Elizabeth Warren about 2/3 of the time, but she can get off on these rants about, you know, corporations being evil, and it can be a lot for the middle of the country to take.
Well, yeah,
I think that she would have at least as much of a chance of alienating segments of the electorate.
That was the Democrat.
Jeez,
now the Republican.
I didn't know the filibuster rule would have been lifted. All right. So Elizabeth Warren is, you know, sort of an attractive candidate. I'm just saying that as a fan, but she's, you know, she's got a lot going for her, except for her ideology, which comes first, last, always. And it is extremely left wing, and it is extremely hostile to what I think 97, 98, or maybe even 99% of the Americans understand to be, you know, the correct ordering of American society. She truly believes that corporations are nearly immoral and have to be corralled and regulated to, you know, the nth degree. She has no faith in the average board of directors, the average CEO, the average middle management. She doesn't buy it. And she is an extremist. And that is not going to help Hillary Clinton
get to the
middle.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, come on.
Well, look, who's out there farther? Sherrod Brown? I don't know who you would find. You say, well,
she's not. Look, she's a left-wing maniac. Look, establishing the Financial Responsibility Board, that brainchild of hers, was a fantastic thing she did.
Wall Street
does need to be reined in. There is a need to regulate corporations. Corporations cannot be allowed to be free reign.
But you're forgetting all of the stuff about responsible government. You see, this is exactly where the EU ended up. That consumer finance board that she created is virtually unaccountable to the American people because it's got its own source of funding. Even with the elections, the people are appointed, the head of that agency is appointed for a term that goes beyond a given president. And so
the point, though. The point being that it's not political, that it's not.
No, I'm sorry. The point of American government is that it is responsible to voters on a regular basis.
Except when Chris doesn't want them to be responsible to voters on a regular basis.
I think it should be responsible to voters on a clearly delineated regular basis. She doesn't.
just like the Congress was responsible to the voters and as a point allowed Barack Obama to have the eighth year of his presidency. Oh, wait, no, they didn't. Or that they didn't filibuster everything. Or that they didn't deny him the ability to appoint people. You are being selective in your outrage in this case.
If Obama understood the, you know, if he got a Merriam-Webster dictionary and opened up to C-O-M-P-R-I-S-E, perhaps he would begin to move in the direction of a Bill Clinton, who was able to learn from the voters at every one of the elections that took place during his presidency. And he's got the legislative achievements to show for it, which is the polar opposite of Barack. I know better than everybody else in this room.
Yeah, that whole health care for 20 million people. Ha! No achievement there.
All right, so let's go local. Let's finish up here. July 1st here, Friday, will mark. It's a big date in Illinois politics. It's now somehow a formality or more of like an anniversary holder. But it is a day that a budget's supposed to be in place. We'll be coming up on a year. Where are we with this? Because we're seeing a lot of mudslinging in the press. I saw that the GOP has taken out ads, you know, for the election. There continues to be a lot of talk in the media, but not a lot that's getting done.
Yeah, there is a they're having a meeting tomorrow. They're having a leaders meeting tomorrow, and then both the House and the Senate are in session on Wednesday. And the significance of July 1st is that is the first day of our new fiscal year, which will be another year without a budget. There are people who always want to blame it's all Madigan's fault. The fact is, as Crane said this morning, the governor has been unable to achieve anything by way of compromise with the Democrats.
That is untrue. The first person who would say that's untrue is Mike Madigan, and my reference, and everybody can go see it for themselves. Go to the City Club of Chicago website and take a look at Mike Madigan's recitation of the half dozen serious, significant legislative accomplishments that he and Bruce Rauner put together. It's not Dave Lundy, not Chris Roebling. That's Mike Madigan, and he recites them with typical Madiganistan precision. Okay? So Cranes has got its head someplace it doesn't belong. All right? Forget about Cranes. Let's talk about reality. I think you have to say, when you run, it's just like Obama. You run and you say, I want to be president. Well, then you have to be responsible. Now, Obama said, I don't have to be responsible because the guy who came before me was George Bush. That's not Bruce Rauner. Bruce Rauner is responsible for what Bruce Rauner has or has not done. And I don't think there's any question about that. But so too is Mike Madigan. And what guys, my friend Dave Lundy here, love for everybody to forget is that the Democrats had 12 years in which they controlled everything and they did nothing except reward their union backers, who are, in fact, the folks who call the tune for the Illinois Democratic Party, the party of government.
All right, Dave Lundy, I'm going to give you the last word here.
It's
like the human malarkey detector here. I'm just going like, oh, my God, Chris.
Madigan is not controlled by the
unions? How deep are we?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, the first actual, look, everybody who's ever heard me knows I'm no fan of the former governor, Pat Quinn. But the reality is that Madigan and Cullerton and Quinn made the first real dent, not only in our unpaid bills. Right. Our fiscal house was getting in order. We were for the first time paying all of our pension payments. Chris likes to conveniently forget that fact, but now we're paying nothing. And Madigan, while he's had his issues and while he certainly was responsible for a lot of what we're in today, along with 26 consecutive years of Republican governors, Madigan, though, managed to do budgets.
Wait, 15, 16 years ago?
Somehow managed to get budgets done with every single one of those Republican governors for 26 consecutive years, but somehow we can't get it done now. What has changed?
We've got a Republican governor who's standing up to the unions.
Cranes is talking about the business publication of Chicago when they're in their lead editorial saying, Governor Rauner, you proved us wrong.
There it is. There's the...
Touche.
Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, our regular segment here on The Download. Touche on Monday night. See you next Monday, guys.
See ya.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Coming up, Chris Caskey, the president of Pitchfork Media, is going to join us. The Pitchfork Empire, everything from their website to their publications to their festivals, the big one coming up here in July in Chicago. We're going to talk with Chris about all of it. Bob Kessler, how are you, my man?
Doing great. Good. On a Monday.
It's amazing to work with you. I know that you've had a long lineage here at WGN.
I've been here a minute or two.
Dude, weren't you? You said I read somewhere that you started as a producer here.
This is true.
1994?
This is also true.
Oh, interesting.
OJ was the big story that summer.
that's kind of big again. That's the exact year that I started producing as well. So
we, at another radio station.
At a different radio station. Yeah. But I feel like we would have a lot of fun rehashing mid-90s
news. We're contemporaries, dude. We would.
Remember the World Cup?
That was here that year. Yes, I do.
That's all we would do for a whole show. Kessler and Kaufman.
Remember?
Reminisce
what
about.
What else was it? World Cup?
Well, the 94 was a big year. 95, you had the heat wave.
Yeah.
Right? 96, you had the DNC here, the Democratic Convention.
That was the big one.
Then the rest doesn't matter. Like the next 20.
No, it all gets fuzzy after that.
After that, it's just, it's all.
And now
computers.
Here we are. And what year? Now I've forgotten. What year is this?
It's 1995, Bob. You've only been working for 6 months. So it all works out.
No, if I'd sound as good if I had only 6 months experience.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the Pitchfork Music Festival is just around the corner. The festival sets up in Union Park on Chicago's Near West Side, and it's become a staple for summer music lovers since 2005. This year is no different. The headliners like Broken Social Scene, Brian Wilson performing Pet Sounds, and Chicago R&B hitmaker Jeremiah. Well, all right, I'm going. The festival, of course, is the arm of the Pitchfork empire. The music site has grown to be one of the most dominant review sites around, not to mention the feature and multimedia content they produce as well. And the company is settling in after being purchased by Condé Nast last year. Not bad for a startup from Logan Square. So what's the secret to keeping a music media company thriving? Why don't we ask Pitchfork's first ever employee, now president, Chris Caskey. Chris, welcome to The Download. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So let's talk about this year's festival. I mean, you guys have obviously been in business for over a decade here. What is the theme? What are you trying to accomplish with the 2016 Pitchfork Fest?
We're trying to accomplish the same thing we tried to accomplish with our first festival back in 2005, which is being, you know, as your kind introduction kind of said, I mean, we're a music publication that exists online. And when we founded the festival, a lot of the impetus behind it was to create a tangible environment to celebrate the music that we were covering in love, the audience that was reading the site, the musicians that were reading the site, and then, you know, ultimately the community that had been kind of bubbling up and that we were finding relative but great success existing within. So not having a print side, not having things like that, we wanted to replicate that feeling and put it into a real-world setting. So every year has been an iteration and a growth and an optimization of what we do every year prior. So the goal is to celebrate music, right, and then have an event that with, you know, ancillary existence, providing just fans with a comprehensive point where you walk in the room, and the room being a big park.
Right.
And your focus is on the music, and all of the rest of it is there to support that feeling. So,
you know, when you guys started, there was a lot of creative risks. You had a lot of artists coming in who were maybe, you know, doing their full record, their famous record, or maybe bringing some artists in that maybe twisted genres or were different than the norm. As you get older, do you run the risk, or what are the challenges that go with continuing to be creative when you now have thousands of people coming to the door looking for a mainstream festival?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, the festival market's become a very interesting beast. There's a lot of festivals, and I would argue there's also probably a lot of homogenization amongst these festivals. So for us, the focus has always been somewhat indulgent, considering it's the second piece of our business, the media being the first piece, that we can have a little bit more fun in some ways with it. So if you look at what we do and the program that we put forward, I think the redundancy that you see across other festivals is extremely minimal, if any. I mean, I think if you were to compare us to Coachella, a much larger festival, obviously, you know, it's an equally large global brand. But I think we only have maybe 5 or 6 artists playing our festival that played Coachella. So if you know, we've carved out an identity for ourselves that is, again, it's focused on maybe what's emerging and what's coming up, and then it's celebrating things that we value and love from the past. And that kind of combination of new and old, and ultimately also kind of just flying under the umbrella of Pitchfork and not being about just having a big act.
Right.
And being about the acts at noon being as important and potentially meaningful as those closing the day, that type of approach is something that I don't really think a lot of music festivals take. That's not the approach they take.
What's your process when picking a lineup? I mean, do you go out of your way to make sure that it's not the same stuff you're going to see at Lollapalooza or at other festivals that might be in the area?
Out of your way might be a little extreme, but we definitely are mindful of avoiding what seems to be like just like the glut of bands that play every festival. So for us, a lot of it is instinct, and a lot of the first bands we book are the ones that are the smallest and that we're most excited about that no one's even heard of yet, and it's obviously counter to what, you know, running successful business looks like. But when you think about on top of that, it's being unique is paramount. There's definitely a lot of work put forth to make sure that that thoughtfulness is going into the program. And we don't accept submissions. Everything is very much us going outwards. So with only 44 to 46 slots available,
right,
there's only so much we can do, you know. So it's more effort than
– because of your roots in Chicago, because your office is in Logan Square, do you put an emphasis on trying to make sure that there's a local representation?
Absolutely. I mean, it's never going to be too heavy just because being in Chicago and this being our home and where we've grown – there's a need to show that respect and that love for the city. But being a global brand and a festival with global kind of perspective, it's only possible with the amount of slots that we have. But I think this year, which again, you go in and you want to have a few things happening, but this year, more than any other year, I think we've got more Chicago representation happening. If I'm being totally honest, that we did not plan for per se. That and it's just a nice – it's a representation of what's happening in the Chicago music scene, which is exciting.
Well, we'll talk about that. But you know, I'm interested because your festival has grown and grown and grown to a point where – I mean, I remember going to one of the earlier festivals and then going last year to see Chance the Rapper and being mm-hmm. like, I don't know. First of all, I'm way too old for this.
Likewise.
Second of all, I couldn't believe how many people were there. I mean, it was just like – it was so intense. Pitchfork has had such a great run. How do – as a festival organizer – how do you make sure that you continue with what we just talked about, making sure you have a great lineup and grow with your audience in the sense that, you know, you have enough porta potties and,
right.
and, you know, like having a contingency plans and make sure and all the things that go along with putting on a festival?
No, completely. I mean, I think the one asterisk I'll add to your comment, which is true, but is that we, you know, we've actually stayed in the same park and had the same right. attendance, generally speaking. With the exception of a few thousand kind of people that we can add in.
I'm probably just getting old.
No, there's
so many people now.
But there's truth to it because what's happening now is that people are recognizing that thing I was saying earlier, which is you come in at noon and you stay all day.
Yeah,
so
right.
it's more crowded for longer periods of time now than someone just coming to see Wilco or just coming to see Chance. I mean, obviously, those are big moments. But the festival is largely a far more crowded atmosphere because I'd like to think we've done a good job of building things for people to do. If they get tired of the music or they need shade and they need a drink or food – so for us, I mean, if you were to ask me what's new this year and what's the most exciting thing, there's never been a good answer for that. It's always pretty mundane because what you do, and it's like what any business should do, what we try to do on our site, is every year there's optimizations made. There's porta potties. There's more ATMs. There's bigger screens, better sound equipment. You know, there's essentially logistical and production level mm-hmm. optimizations that we're making that are never designed to be pointed to and say, oh, this is a better festival suddenly. We want people to leave every year and think that it was better than the prior year and have no real reason that they know why, because the program should be equally good on a year-to-year basis. They should just walk away thinking it's better, and that's our job, is to kind of keep those changes subtle.
As a president of Pitchfork and all of you guys get together to organize a festival, do you, like, the week after, do you debrief and be like, okay, what didn't work? And be able to fix it for the next year?
I think we normally know about it the minute it's not working. So the debriefing is absolutely happening, but we take that first week and we take a vacation. But after that, yeah, I mean, every year you sit down and it starts with kind of like your blue sky. What do you want the most of? I mean, for a long time, we really wanted, you know, video screens. And that took us a while just to get to our production to a level where we could afford it, frankly. And then you want better sound equipment and you want larger stages and then you want better lighting. So those things are always – there's a lot of wants on your list. And then that want lives next to the need column. And when those converge, you take action. But thankfully, there hasn't ever – I mean, with, you know, storm control and with rain and the potential variables of all the different things that can happen, we're always thinking about it. But the good news is there's so few of us at the core of it. That it you know, we treat it like a family and we kind of have our fingers so, for probably unnecessarily so, touching it so right. closely that when we're done with it, you just look at it and be like, we did that wrong. And we know exactly what's already happening when it's happening. So the good news, again, is that we can then take that and it's not like some sweeping change. It just becomes we shift the stage 45 feet. The sound becomes 80% better because it's bouncing less off of X, Y, or Z. And we figured it out and the audience is none the wiser.
Chris Caskey is my guest. He's the president of Pitchfork. Let's take a break. We come back.
Cool.
We'll shift from the festival, talk about the rest of the empire.
Let's do it.
The Pitchfork Music Festival happens here in July. Chris Caskey is my guest. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. My guest in studio at the big table, Chris Caskey. He's the president of Pitchfork. unbelievable music media company, I guess is what you would call it, which publication, with the website and also the festival, which happens here in Chicago and also in Paris, which is, we'll talk about your international roots. But take us back to Chicago when this site started, when you started in 2004-ish.
Ish, yeah.
What were you trying to accomplish with Pitchfork?
Well, it was only two of us, and I think what we recognized was that it was leaving a moment where it wasn't nearly – looking back, it's easy to look at and point to. But at the time, we recognized that music was suddenly kind of ubiquitously available, and it was omnipresent. It was no longer the label structure that had as much meaning. Napster had kind of come and gone. MP3s existed. There's already obviously been a trading culture within like some of the jam band scenes, and music was everywhere. And at the same time, you know, the focal point of the site to that point had been, let's cover artists that are, you know, off the beaten path, that aren't just the biggest because they're on major labels and – they need to be on a cover magazine. Let's be a site that's different from that. And at the same, you know, when you shift that over to having not just being a voice for undiscovered artists or less talked about artists, it was also a scene where everyone else was kind of giving up on music in many ways, especially the criticism component of it. It became a lifestyle. It became trying to be some like everything to everybody. And we never wanted to be everything to everybody. We wanted to be really good at what we did, at whatever we were doing, of course. And at the same time, knowing that we didn't have the money to start a print magazine and we knew we had the audience that could support it as we were building it, we just wanted to – we set out to say, okay, it was very simple. I mean, it was like the festival was our physical counterpart in a way to offer something. If you look at like the umbrella of what we could be, that's a piece of – it's even adding the critical eye to what an event is. And it's a festival run by people that go to music festivals for a living, right? So with the site, it was let's redefine what the semantic of magazine means and what the publication is, and what does that mean for the internet. So whether that be how you design it, how you distribute it, how you think about writing it, the types of content you're creating, it was ambitious, but it just felt like, you know, we've usurped so many costs by not printing this on paper that let's go all in and figure out how to just blow this out.
And when I think of Pitchfork, I think of a couple of things that set the site apart from other sites. Even with Spin and Rolling Stone and other magazines that were online, they were still doing sort of their voice, but your voice was different. Your voice is clever. It's somewhat snarky, but it's also a great place for undiscovered stuff that's not everybody is circulating. But the other thing that was really big about it was the review concept, the decimal point, the idea of instead of stars and 1 through 5, you were doing a 0.0 through 10.
Right.
Talk about why you guys chose to do that as opposed to the normal, everybody knows 5-star reviews.
5 stars are one thing. I mean, you know that it's, that signifies perfect, but there's so much nuance to applying a score, and there's arrogance to it, and there's confidence, and we believe that you have to have like the foundation and the reputation and the like intellect and expertise to actually even be able to weigh in the first place. But when you look at Rolling Stone and everything's, you know, the mean is just 3.5 stars always. Oh. All of music is 3.5 stars. There's not a lot of like variance to that, and that's kind of frustrating. So when you think about also the amount of work that artists are putting into creating this stuff, whether it's in their bedroom or in a studio or beyond, I mean, why not go long on talking about it and get super analytical with how you approach what it is and how it's scored? So on a 100-point scale, essentially, 101, I guess, you can look at it and say – it's a very gray area, and you leave the reader up to interpreting what that score means, with the exception of how you label something like a best new album, for example.
Right.
But everything else is, oh, I know what a 6.3 means on Pitchfork versus a 6.6. Every audience member has every person that reads our site has a different explanation for that, which I think is great. You know, there's no key that's instructing you as to what these things mean. So for some people, think a 6 is terrible. Some people think a 6 is mediocre. Some people don't know necessarily what to think a 6 is. But our goal is to never find that. We never want to just level out at all music being mediocre.
What I love about it, and you know, I kind of joked at the beginning, not bad for a startup from Logan Square, but I mean, you are changing the language. You know, the music language or music review language or how people interact even online has changed because of Pitchfork. The 6.0 and giving opportunities for people to express themselves or to have a better understanding of what goes into music. I mean, Pitchfork is at the forefront of that.
Yeah.
That, to me, is what I'm getting at, that you guys have not only dominated, but you've created new language.
No doubt about it. And I think you don't set out to create it, but I think what you do set out to create is to show how important music is to us specifically and then to everyone that likes music, which is everyone. I mean, music's like pizza, and it's like a universal language. So to just dismiss it, and especially as music becomes more available and just you can click away from something immediately – that's not romantic anymore, and nostalgia is a part of music, and information is, and learning, and everyone's time is precious. So, you know, if you think about even how we're structuring the site now, We want to be as accessible and as useful to someone that's looking at it 30 times a day as you do to someone that's able to check you once a month and print out your best new music page. Like, there should be a home for everybody. There should music should never feel like you can't get in. And when you think about how you talk about it and how you analyze it and what it means, it's to showcase and like replicate it. It's the importance of it in the cultural landscape, right? So, I mean, changing the language and changing I think it democratized and leveled the playing field for kind of what matters. We weren't beholden mm-hmm. to the music industry. We're in Chicago, looking outsiders, looking in on LA and New York, and having this. No one knew who we were, and we were avoiding press, and you know, like. Just kind of lived in the shadows and like, who are these people from Pitchfork?
At what point did you and Ryan and everyone else who was in that room recognize and realize that this was a phenomenon, that Pitchfork was growing, that you'd have to add people, but that this wasn't just sort of a music blog that people read?
There was two things that happened. First of which was we started kind of looking through your email accounts and all the unread email that you had and search query terms like Times or Tribune or, you know, and then suddenly you found reporters like, what is going on over here? Like, so many people had been diminishing digital as a different and terrible medium compared to print, when we always felt like the semantics of the business model, which is print and digital, all that mattered was what's in the middle of that, mm-hmm. which is the content that's going out there. So people were starting to take us seriously, and you saw the effect on like record labels and the music in the smaller music industry, where we would say something and then suddenly you're putting it in front of a lot more people than otherwise would have been able to be exposed to it, and it had a meaningful impact on their business. It was just anecdotal that you'd learn, because that wasn't our job. But I think, you know, the first festival we did was one thing, but I think in the Pitchfork Music Festival in 2006 was when, you know, you stood on stage and you look out to an audience of, you know, 18,000 people, and these people, they're singing along to the words of, you know, God, even who knows what the band would have been or what the example I could come up with would be. But thinking about that 4 years prior, when that artist was, you know, is a barista and they're just playing music at clubs and the music isn't available and being talked about, it's night and day. And in that feeling of seeing how important it was to the artists, like seeing them turn around and freak out with their bandmates and then turn around and watch the crowd love what they're doing, and have Les Heavy Fav is a band that, you know, they were playing, they've been rock band forever, and suddenly they're in front of all these people and the biggest show they ever play, and they're, you know, it's a surreal moment, and we definitely look at each other like, all right, well, this is just kind of like a sample size of what's happening, what we do on a day-to-day basis on the internet, much larger than this. So I think it was a pretty heady moment for us, because we had to then sit back and say, all right, well, you know, Reckless was never the intent, but we have to at least think about, right. You know, before every opinion we're right. Never going to let be filtered, but just taking a minute to think about ourselves is you push publish, it goes out to millions of people suddenly, and
yeah,
it
there's
didn't
a
do that before.
Yeah,
there's
right.
a different responsibility to that, and the responsibility we've ultimately decided is no different from what it was, which is to be honest and give our honest opinion and see where it goes, but... It was pretty heady. It was a lot of moments that added up to some pretty surreal, you know. Thankfully, since it all lives online, we wouldn't have to like live it in person all the time. There's no celebrity attached to it. It's I could still go home and not have to worry about it. But if you think about it, equating it to that, it's definitely pretty wild.
Let's take a break for the news. We'll come back, and I'd love to talk about now, because Condé Nast bought Pitchfork yep. in the fall, and you guys had kind of built yourself as sort of an independent, as you mentioned, about being able to be in Chicago and look out. But you have offices now in New York, mm-hmm. also one a remote office in L.A.
Yep, yep, yep.
But talk about growth and about the idea of being able to retain that independent vibe that made Pitchfork so successful in the late 2000s. Chris Caskey is my guest. He's the president of Pitchfork Music. We'll continue our conversation right after the news. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Chris Caskey. He's the president of Pitchfork. Of course, the festival, the site, everything that goes with Pitchfork. I mean, do you still consider Chicago or Pitchfork a Chicago company?
Absolutely. As much as we have offices now in a lot of places and we have music festivals in other places, I think that being a Chicago company from a literal headquarters standpoint, as well as thinking about the ideologies and kind of the approach with which we live our lives, it's a lot of it is founded in just what Chicago has taught us directly or indirectly, I think. So, yeah, I mean, this is our home.
Let's talk about the purchase, the Condé Nast purchase. Mm-hmm. They came in, the publishing company that does Vanity Fair and a lot of huge titles, came in and purchased Pitchfork back in October. How's it been? I mean, we're talking now coming up on eight months. Yep. Do you feel like everything is going smoothly with a boss?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the operative word is that we had never had a boss before, and it doesn't necessarily feel like we have one now, because, you know, without going into a 2-hour-long conversation about just like the ways in which this all worked and how it worked, at the end of the day, if we wanted to grow and if we wanted to have all of our wonderful people who work for us across all sorts of different areas, everyone's ambitions were, you know, hitting ceilings. You know, we could only do so much. And you see the ambition and you see that dissatisfaction that comes from not being able to accomplish what you want. And it's my job, of course, is to keep pushing that forward and creating opportunity. And there's a lot of opportunity that exists, especially on the internet and in the digital world with startups and everything else. And for us, we didn't need just that. We needed people that were experts in that as well, and that could have real insight in historical precedence in operating something like a media brand like what Pitchfork is. So there was a moment in 2013 where we were nominated for an award. It's the Ask Me Awards, like the National Magazine Awards, and we were nominated for General Excellence for, you know, Website of the Year. So that basically the equivalent of, there's two of those awards. One goes to digital, one goes to print. And we were up against 3 or 4 Condé Nast brands, and those brands like The New Yorker and, like you said, Vanity Fair, and we have Vogue, and you have GQ, and these are brands that we respect, read, worship, admire, you know, just are humbled by, and we were up competing against them and nominated for this award. And then we won. And so that moment was not like, you're not about winning awards, your life isn't about awards, but it was a moment where we felt as though all of the work in some ways that we had done in the kind of more mundane inside baseball version of what we do, which is trying to be a magazine, trying to be a brand that is just like every other brand from a creative standpoint. It's just a matter of what our like way of distributing the content is that we were there. And the irony of that then became that we started having conversations with Condé Nast, and they agreed with that, which is, you live alongside The New Yorker, you belong alongside GQ. I mean, you're as important of a brand to music as GQ is to style and fashion in menswear, and as Vogue is for fashion and style and, you know, social commentary. So we had a home there, and, you know, long and short of it was we can get to a point where we have these people who have built these brands over 100 years, and they're an independent company. So they're, you know, as much as we're now owned, we're still, you know,
part of an independent.
The cute part is that we're still part of, we have our own voice still.
What, I mean, you're not going to talk bad about your boss, but, you know, the challenges of being bought by a company that has all these brands. I mean, your consumer, and a little bit on the static pushback of, like, they're a very alt-savvy, independent-thinking audience.
Yep.
There's a lot of sellout kind of conversations around. So how do you avoid, as a brand, Pitchfork, one that really has really been a part of that movement, that independent movement, to not have consumers fall out of love with you because you're not independent
anymore? Yeah, no, I think, and it's a great question, and it's something we're absolutely mindful of, and you have to be, you know, vigilant and diligent about protecting yourself. So the pressures that you feel from something like Condé Nast are not negative ones. They're all challenges, and it's all experimentation, because the world of media is evolving in so many ways outside of us and outside of Condé Nast. And for us, like, it comes down to something that might be cliche, but it's about the work that we do. Like, if we go and we become a part of Condé Nast and our work starts to stink, then people will look at you and say, well, you did
full
it wrong.
Full glossy pages and stuff, like, in Pitchfork and stuff.
It's, I feel like it would be really clear to an audience like you described, which I agree with. It's, you have an audience that is loyal to you, that trusts what you say. You respect them. You respect that trust. And your job is to protect that and to give them things to read and like to look for and make sure that the 15 or so years of history you have that they can then reference online is as good as the 15 years after it. And I think that people are savvy enough with the amount of noise that exists right now that they see right through something that's not legitimate. And so for us, it's beyond our internal questioning and challenging to make sure we're making the right decisions and we're thinking about things in appropriate fashion. It's really just comes down to the instincts and saying, all right, well, what would we say does this make me feel like a sellout? Because if the answer is yes, your audience is going to feel the same way.
You know, on the same token, I was just, Pete and I were talking about this before the interview, just about, you guys have become the dominant brand when it comes to music reviews. You know, it's not just anymore the little guy gets his mixtape reviewed.
Right.
Now it's everybody from Sony Music down wants a good rating in Pitchfork. How do you deal with the remnants of the music industry coming around and offering shiny things to make sure that Pitchfork gives them a good review? All the things that we've heard about in the history of media and the music industry, how does Pitchfork avoid playing favorites to the industry that still remains?
Yeah, you know, the beauty of it is, I think by being in Chicago and by being in the shadows, that we never had any of that.
Yeah,
it's not baloney. It's like we were never getting all these things that you see on TV or you hear about. That wasn't our world. Like, people could barely find our email addresses. So mailing address, getting CDs in the mail was as far as it got. And
that was a success.
Yeah. And we're like, yeah, we get free music. And this is the best part of our job. You know, like, who doesn't want to listen to music all day? And, you know, with regards to how the music industry has evolved and the its remnants is an apt way of putting it, but it's more just like, I think there's some re-identifying that's happening in a really healthy way where people, even major labels, are realizing that you need to have an identity to exist. You need to have like a brand that means something to people. Otherwise, you're just like, what good are you doing? Someone like Chance doesn't sign with a label because he can send his message out on his own. So if you're a label, like, where do you add the value now and what's your game? And so for us, like, being on Pitchfork and is our job to make sure we're listening to music and being exposed to it. But any temptation that exists or otherwise is, it's similar to like the selling out token. I mean, we're covering Justin Bieber records now, not because we're suddenly trying to amass an audience, but because Justin Bieber is working with Diplo, who works with MIA and who is like a part of our world now. And we'd be irresponsible not to cover it. So, you know, I think, yeah, the music industry is funny, but the best part and the simplest way to probably sum it up is that we've always been respectful of the music industry because of release dates and the product, mm-hmm. like physical product specifically, when it was mattering more. There's a real business behind that, and you don't want to make something, you don't want to talk about something and have it not be available or do it any artist to disadvantage, because that's who ultimately you're hurting. But we never existed as a part of the music industry. Like, we live on the peripherals. We're a media company that happens to talk about music, so we're reliant on the creation of music and the fact that music keeps being created and put out in the world. But we don't care if Chance is putting a mixtape out or if Universal's putting a record out and putting bookends at Target. You know,
you don't have Jack Condé Nast or whoever, the guy playing golf, and he's like, my son's got a new record. You got to check
there's that. And every time that anyone does, not from Condé Nast, but the amount of times that someone's tried to give me a record, and almost every I don't think there's been a moment where I haven't said I won't listen to this, not because I devalue your art, not because I don't want to, but like, let's just leave it. Let's leave our relationship as is. And then if you want to think about the music thing, like, let's figure out a different pathway for that, because this is not how it works. I mean, that's just not how we – I don't golf, you know?
All right, let's talk about Chicago. You know, do you see a Pitchfork, a future of Pitchfork not here? You know, at some point or another, you're blowing up in Paris. New York City is, I mean, obviously your second home, and now L.A. is coming up. At what point do you entertain the idea that Chicago, for all the things that we talked about, that you're not involved in, it's great to be outside, that it might be smarter for you guys to be closer to the industry?
You know, I think it's a hard question to answer. For me personally, and I don't believe that – you can never say never, so I'd be hesitant to be on record saying never. But I don't think that from a creative standpoint and from what we need to do that there's ever a need to leave Chicago. Just because if you go down just like to the brass tacks of what this city is, it's 30% cheaper to live here than it is in New York. So if you want to write for our site or you want to sell or you want to do whatever – coming here, it's a good move for you. Yeah. And there's a creative culture that exists here, whether it be musically or otherwise, that rivals any other major market in our country. So it would be doing the city a disservice to think that there's a need to get closer to any one industry, because ultimately the ad industry is fragmented, the music industry is fragmented, and it's kind of everywhere. And ultimately the benefit of the internet is that the internet is everywhere. So we live there. So, you know, being part of Chicago is, you know, as far as I guess if it's within my control, it's always a piece of our home. Now, the festival in Chicago is also as unique as it is, and it's what it is. And we don't replicate that model. Like, the Paris Festival is half the size. It's indoor. It's in the winter. And it's very much designed for a Parisian audience, a French audience, and a European audience most broadly. So it's not like we took a model that worked here and moved it. It's a completely different business and a completely different, like, creative outlet. So if we do something in L.A. or we do something in Vancouver or we go to Australia, it would be a new version of something that made sense for Vancouver or made sense for Melbourne or made sense for L.A. because it can't just be what we do here, because what we do here works because it's here. What we do elsewhere will have to work in ways that make sense for wherever that elsewhere might be.
You've seen some of the other festivals in town have, I guess you would call it, growing pains. You see Riot Fest having trouble with Humboldt Park and moving to Douglas Park. Lollapalooza seems to continue to have problems with Grant Park, everything from fence jumpers to everything that happens.
We'll have 100,000 people in one spot, I guess, right?
But for you guys, I mean, do you foresee any troubles with Chicago and the idea of performing a festival in a public park?
I think so. I think troubles is the wrong word, but I think that because that signifies just like people issues. I think more of the issue is that almost similar to the way that people are like being exposed to music and listening to music, that there's so many festivals here and in every region, state, city, that unless you're a diligent listener and a follower of Pitchfork or you know what's going on, beyond us working hard to create our differentiation, you know, at some point, like, there's just enough's enough. There's too much of this. Like, I don't – there's too many festivals. And when a lot of these festivals are – they exist as businesses for 3 days and then they wait for an entire year to do it again, their focus is on business first. And rightly so, of course. But, like, for us, the focus on a successful festival is number one, but it's a piece of a much larger business. So while we can talk about it all year round and we can think about it, it depressurizes the, kind of the constraint or the overzealousness that you might put towards your event because – you know, your life isn't made or broken over one weekend. So, you know, when Riot Fest has issues, it's a business that needs to succeed. So they got to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And so for us, you know, again, someone that's far more driven by financial gain, which is always something you're mindful of, you make decisions and you start to sacrifice that and you get in your problematic. But I think that the risk more in Chicago is going to be the glut of noise that exists and how to cut through that. And it's on us, it's on every festival to figure out how you differentiate and make sure people are aware of what you do. So, you know, it's a different game now.
Well, this festival, the 2016 Pitchfork Fest, is going to be at Union Park. What's the one act that you're looking forward to? Like, what's something that you would like to recommend here to the WGN audience?
I think the thing that I'm probably personally most excited to see, and it's mostly because it spans, it's cross-generational, and it, you know, but it's Brian Wilson. So you have someone that is coming to perform Pet Sounds, which is my, I'll be standing next to my dad, you know, like that. He and my mom just inspired my passion for music and what I do, and they love Brian Wilson, and I grew up with Brian Wilson, and suddenly, you know, the full circle has arrived. So that will be neat, and I think that that story is replicated across everyone that likes music, especially that reads Pitchfork. And then as far as someone that's kind of on the other side of that, I think there's a kid, this kid called Car Seat Headrest, who is, he looks like he's 12 years old. He's probably 23. It makes me feel like a grandfather, but he's someone that is, you know, in a world where EDM's taking shape and there's a lot of kind of like just party music that's happening. He has a profound respect for indie rock in its purest form and the pioneers of indie rock. And even in a literal sense, he'll go and be quoting things or he'll throw like an homage in mid-song. But he's just got a very unique sound, a very unique approach to the way he makes music, at least it seems. And he's just is a level-headed kid that is making awesome stuff. And I think that he's someone that you look 2004 and you're like, you could see him bubbling up in world domination suddenly. And it's louder now, so that doesn't happen as easily in the music world. But he's someone that deserves it and is wearing his intent is very transparent, which I think still speaks to me even though I'm aging. And it goes back to the sellout themes and everything else. You know, you see this and you're like, this kid's the real deal, you know?
There you go. That's a good endorsement for that kid.
Yeah.
The president of Pitchfork going, that kid's the real deal. We'll take it, right?
And then he comes and he's like wearing brand T-shirts and he's just like getting paid by McDonald's. To,
yeah, you
who knows, out. Soccer jersey style.
The Pitchfork Fest is at Union Park this July. Chris Kasky is the president of Pitchfork and he was my guest tonight here on The Download. Thanks so much for taking some time out.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Our MLB All-Stars, Chicago Cubs, Chris Bryant and Anthony Rizzo, are on fire tonight. Chris Bryant, look at these numbers. And right now they're winning the game 10-7 in the eighth, going into the ninth. Chris Bryant is 5-for-5,
mm-hmm.
two doubles,
mm-hmm.
six RBIs,
mm-hmm.
four runs,
mm-hmm.
and three home runs.
No triple.
Yeah, or single.
Or single, yeah.
Yeah, that's weak.
Can't get the cycle.
That's weak. I should have known. I should have led with that. He can't hit singles. That's amazing.
Also and then, ripped his pants.
Did he rip his pants?
Yeah.
And then Anthony Rizzo also went yard, added double to that. They were able to put up. They're essentially accounting for seven of the. I mean, it's only 7 of the 10 runs, but nice explosion. Arrieta was not good tonight.
Yeah, he's he's had a couple of rough outings.
They seem to sort of peg him, you know what I mean? Like guys in like teams in the NL Central starting to do that thing where they kind of figure if you know hit a team, and you know that was the big every newscast today on WGN. Well, he returns to the scene of the crime where he no hit this team earlier this season. You know they're like, there's no way you're no hitting us again. Right?
No. Well, I mean, has it happened?
I don't know. But the thing that's really interesting is Jake Arrieta had 5 walks tonight. He walked 5 guys.
Yeah, I think that his last 2 starts, he has as many walks as Clayton Kershaw has this entire season.
Oh, man.
10.
Kershaw got
or 18.
Lit. He got lit up last night, too. First time. The it is interesting, though, because you and I went to the game a couple weeks ago where Arrieta labored, meaning he threw 100 and some odd pitches before the 5th inning.
Mm-hmm.
But he also racked up like 12 strikeouts.
Yeah.
But there is something to maybe the scouting report on a Jake Arrieta is to let him pitch.
Make him work. Get those pitches
yeah,
up.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Like, don't jump him. Because that's the one thing that always boggles me about Clayton Kershaw, any pitcher in baseball. How do you not walk? I mean, you're right. I think Clayton Kershaw has 8 walks in the entire season. You know, there's some pitchers that can get that in one game. But what is it about Clayton Kershaw? Is he just always throwing strikes, or does he have the kind of delivery and the way that that hitters are trying to be aggressive with?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Like, some pitchers get that nod where get him early.
Mm-hmm.
Hit that fastball early because later he's got filthy stuff and he's going to trick you.
Mm-hmm.
So try to get him on the first pitch kind of thing. Because it seems like Kershaw's never – it's not like he's battling a ton of 3-2 counts and on precision, you know, getting called third strikes instead of a walk, you know. I think he's just – the ball's just getting put in play. He strikes out a lot of guys too.
Yeah. I'm worried about the Cubs.
What?
Could that be
– That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I am.
Well, see, this is the problem with Cubs fans is the expectations are so high for a team that right now it looks like Texas is going to lose tonight. I love we're already in the wild card baseball. Texas, who has 49 wins, they're down to the Yankees right now late in the game. So if the Cubs win, the Cubs will go into a virtual tie with the Texas Rangers for best record in baseball.
The Cubs they don't win close games. They have problems with one-run games. They win very few if they score less than 3 runs.
So they're like, they need these Chris Bryant games.
Yeah, and, you know, you get to the playoffs and you're going against, you know, the team's best pitchers, 2-1, 3-2.
Well, that's why you go and get another hit. I mean, there's been a lot like, what if the Cubs got another slugger? But to be fair, the Chicago Cubs right now, dealing with injuries, Soler's out. Is he back? No, he's out. Dexter Fowler's out, and Kyle Schwarber. That's essentially your starting outfield.
Don't forget Tommy Gunn, Tommy La Stella.
So now you see they had to go get that trade because that's just how baseball works, that they can bring Chris Coughlin back. You know, like I didn't know it was that easy to be like, all right, he can come back. What is that? So they got him back. He's playing every day. Fowler's out, obviously. So, I mean, there's a lot. They're moving guys around. You know,
yeah.
Javi Baez is playing every position. Chris Bryant, I don't even know where he's at in any given game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is something to be said about they're having to count on rookies they didn't even think about.
Yeah.
Contreras and Armora, guys like that. So there might be – it might just be these guys probably weren't expected to be on the field like this in real action supporting a team. And they're going to lose some close games, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's why you got Jason Hayward. Now go get another. Who would you get? If you were in the – real quick, who would you get?
I don't know if I'd add a hitter. They need relief pitching. They need, like, back end. You know, every time I see that, you know, pointy nose Trevor Cahill come out there, I'm like, oh, man, this
Wait,
is
was
not...
that the nickname we gave him, pointy nose? I don't think we gave one to him, did we?
So I just get nervous that he's, you know, he comes – That would be my first thing to get, some like back end relief help.
I'd say Mike Trout, but that's me. You know, I don't know what it takes to get him, but trade a Trevor Cahill for him. I guess it works anything like the basketball, NBA basketball. You just will it and they trade. Let's trade Derrick Rose for, I don't know, who cares? A bunch of pieces that'll never see the day, you know.
Package Coughlin. In a deal for Trout.
Right. Probably. We'll give you Coughlin. We'll give you a 3rd-round pick. And we'll give you, I don't even know who would be a third. You know, Trevor Cahill. Right? And you're all set for Trout. I think it's only fair. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock in Studio 435, the band White Mystery. How great is that? To have White Mystery in studio rocking Studio 435, the brother-sister ferocious rock and roll duo. It's played everything from Riot Fest to toured the world. The Chicago's very own White Mystery will be in studio at 10 o'clock. Play some music live for the Michigan Avenue folk and you at home. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Right now, though, it's 9 o'clock, and it means it's time for Lee Bay, our architecture contributor here to The Download. Lee and I have had numerous conversations about the Lucas Museum, about the Obama Library, about all the things that are either built or now not being built here in Chicago. Lee Bay, good to see you.
Good to see you, man. Good to see you.
Good to see you. So, you know, let's refresh listeners on this because we've had we've probably talked at length about the preparing for the Lucas Museum. Mm-hmm. You were part of the committee that searched for the site.
Exactly.
So talk quickly about that process so get us up to speed.
Well, very quickly, in 2014, the mayor convened a committee of 14 people, you know, civic people, land, urban planning professionals, whatever, to find a site for this museum. The meeting kicked off in the maybe late winter, early spring of 14, with a meeting with George Lucas himself, who came with his lovely wife Melody and sort of laid out the parameters of the museum. It was great at the Shedd Aquarium, as I recall, and you know, and he answered questions about what the museum was and really laid it out with this Museum of Narrative Art was going to be, which is essentially a museum dedicated to how we tell pictures through story, through images, and yeah. How we tell stories through images
pictures,
and movies.
Right. Yeah.
And then, you know, we went through a 6-week process in which we found the site. We had 2 public meetings, as I recall. We took suggestions from the internet, and I got jumped for suggestions. You know, people saying it should go. Can it go to Uptown Theater? Can it go on the old Southworks site?
And we had talked about a lot of it being space. This was not going to be a small project.
Exactly. You know, a museum at the time that was going to be on the order square footage wise of the Field Museum. So this is a really big. This is 300,000 to 400,000 square feet. This is a really big building. We made our recommendations, and you know, these things are online. So if you look up the Lucas Museum Task Force, you can see still the recommendations that we made. Museum campus site, the Soldier Field parking lot site, turned to be a strong one, we felt at the time, because there was a parking lot already there.
Right.
So there was a structure already on it, underperforming structure, and that it was convenient to everyone. You know, can you put it on the south side? Can you put it on the west side? Can you put it on the north side? We looked at all of that. But all trains run downtown. And so that's what we figured, well, this would be a good place to kind of
okay, get there. So let's flash, fast forward here to 2016.
Yeah.
What was your reaction on Friday?
Not surprised. Not surprised. I mean, this thing had been going on a lot. You know, as you know, Friends of the Park filed the suit based on whether or not the city had the grounds to give away the land on its own, or lease the land on its own to George Lucas. The city kind of put the cart before the horse. It made the memorandum, the agreement with Lucas, and then went to the General Assembly after Friends of the Park filed the suit to get permission to do it.
Is that the same move they did? Was that at the same time they did that move and that also paved the way for the Obama Library? Is that the same? Is that something different?
You know, right around the same time, they did not sue for the Obama Library, right. but they stressed their objection to it being built on park land at the time, even now, either at Jackson Park or Washington Park. What happened is that it's a federal suit, and the judge, John Dara, you know, said the suit had merit. And wouldn't dismiss it, and that kind of gets us where we are now. So it makes the clock get long, and then Lucas, you know, would not look at another site. You know, really wasn't interested in another site. I don't think City Hall was terribly interested for a while to move him to another site until the last minute, sort of,
right.
When this McCormick Place.
Well, I mean, you and I have talked about this. We've talked about the issues that are around this, about mm-hmm. the idea of using parkland or using public space, or this doctrine that sometimes is being used and sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I mean, from your vantage point, where did it go wrong? Because it seems like, you know, they're even with the suit in play. You know, whether before a judge could even make a determination, I mean, there wasn't really a ruling yet that mm-hmm. went one way or the other. The city just kind of walked away. George Lucas walked away. Mm-hmm. What could have been done differently, or what do you think of the way that the sort of process kind of played out?
You know, it's a couple of things. Not being a lawyer, I'm in treacherous ground. Very treacherous ground.
This is Legal Talk with Lee Bay.
That's right. That's right. But the one thing, though, is that the idea that it feels like Lucas will own the building, and through the long length of the lease, which is a century, essentially owned the land, that's where a lot of the public discourse is about, as well as the, you know, the roots of the suit. Had he said, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build this two ways. I'm going to build this thing, but I'm going to deed it to the Park District. Mm-hmm. And I'm done. That may have been less controversial. Certainly may have gave the city a better standing to defend it. Or if he had just said, look, Park District, you build this thing. You know, I'll give you the money, you know, for it, and I'm endowing it, and you guys take care of it. It would have called for a public process. It would have called for perhaps an architectural competition, which we do pretty well in this city for public buildings. And it would have given the sense of openness that I think was happening.
The other thing that you and I talked about was about the communication, or the idea that, you know, people for a long time had no concept of what this was. They thought it was a Star Wars museum. They thought it was they didn't know what it was.
Exactly.
But I mean, at the beginning of this process, George Lucas came and talked to the task force that you were on and told you exactly what it was going to be. And that was enlightening to you as a task force member and the Chicagoan too, to say this is something more than just a Star Wars museum.
Exactly. But the problem is, the issue is, in hindsight, is that he should have taken that speech to every corner of the city to explain what this museum was. It was left to, you know, it was left to the mayor. You know, for one point, it's even left to me as a task force member. I mean, but he should have been the person going to schools, going to community groups, and explaining what this museum is. Would it have staved off the suit? Probably not. But at least people would have a good sense of whether this is a thing that the city really, really wants. And in absence of that, people just said it's a Star Wars museum. I mean, people were saying things like, "Oh, it's going to be the stuff out of his attic. It's going to be this." And it's like, no, it's a real museum. But that never resonated with people.
I'm thinking about you in this process. Obviously, your role in this, you've been a big role, but you've also been outspoken about parkland, about keeping things open and clear and free. You know, we've had a lot of conversations about this. But, you know, looking back at this, I think it's interesting. You've had your own run-ins with Friends of the Park. They were kind of on your tail when you guys were doing Soldier Field, right?
They're like, that's right.
So you have this relationship already with Friends of the Park. Do you feel like they are accurately being portrayed in the media or by Chicagoans, almost the way that they're sort of being vilified as the enemies of the you know, like enemies of the park as opposed to Friends of the Park? What's your take on it? Because you, as an architecture contributor, as a preservationist, you know their role, but they've also been on the other side of the issues of some of the things that you've worked on.
Exactly. You know, this answer has a nuance to it that hopefully I can get across. The city needs defenders of open space. As we've talked, you know, land in this city is either neglected or contested. You need someone who can stand the gap and fix that, right? The thing about this that bothered me was that this act does not result in any preservation of parkland or the creation of new parkland. The sense is that, well, you know, the parking lot is still going to be there, but you can always get rid of the parking lot. No, you can't. That thing was a parking lot before Soldier Field got rebuilt 12 years ago now, and it'll be a parking lot 20 years going on. With the Lucas Museum, you have the chance to, yes, build a museum there. And again, not pristine land. There's a 580,000 square foot convention center just to the south, a 62,000 seat stadium just to the north, and a bunch of museums just to the north of that. So we're not talking about pristine. And it isn't really on a lakefront. I mean, there's a harbor in front of it and Northerly Island. So you can't even see the lake from that point. So I think, so the part that bothers me is that we could have had at least a museum that added at least 4 acres of parkland to the mix,
because the surrounding, the architecture, the designs of it were to sort of to construct the park around it.
Exactly.
Right.
And I believe, and I, you know, said this on Facebook for whatever that's worth, is that I believe that that with them at the table, they could have pushed the design of the building, which was roundly panned, to be better. By pushing that, there needs to be better transit connections to the park space. The park space and building needs to get together more. They could have helped push this to a better design. Others could have helped too. The mayor could have played a bigger role.
Well, we'll get to that. Let's take a quick break. Lee Bay in studio with me, architecture contributor. He's worked for everyone from Sun Times to Public Radio to Mayor Daley. You're in Mayor Daley's office. So much experience beyond planning and architecture here in the city. We'll continue our conversation with Lee after the break. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, My main man, Lee Bay. Lee, architecture contributor here in Chicago, has worked in so many different facets from the media, but he's also been in the mayor's office. He understands planning and architecture better than anybody else in the city.
Thank you.
And you're part of the task force that picked the parking lot, so we can blame it on you.
Blame me, man. Yeah.
Someone needs to be
blamed. I'll take 1/14 of the blame. There were 13 others.
Well, one person that I feel needs to take on more of the blame, and I know this isn't really a political discussion, is the mayor. Mayor Emanuel, it's on his watch. It seems a little bit of hubris in this concept of, I'm just going to make it happen. I'll give you whatever you want. Don't worry about these other things. And it kind of caught up to him. What role does the mayor play when it comes to a museum being able to be built or not built on the lakefront?
You know, this is a good question, because we're talking about a mayor who really, put his stake in this thing and has a track record for getting stuff done when he does that. I mean, the 606 mm-hmm. Bloomingdale Trail on the north
just
side,
up there this
he
weekend,
made that
yeah.
a campaign promise. And you never see a mayor do that, particularly one who's coming into his first term, to say, I'm going to get this thing built, and he'll put his leverage behind it, and he got it built. So he also similarly invested in the Lucas, was smart enough to be able to say, when San Francisco dropped the ball, to say, look, we'll take it. Really, really, really smart. The problem with that is that the buck stops with you. So once you get the thing, what do you do with it? And I think that in some respects, if I may, a couple of mistakes were probably made. One is the one I mentioned earlier, that he should have vetted the site to see how bulletproof it was before becoming public with it, knowing that parkland and lakefront yeah. land is contentious.
It's contentious. No, there's even precedent with Soldier Field, the renovation. They don't
Soldier
want there.
Soldier Field, with the Children's yeah. Museum, right. going to Grant Park. I mean, so oh, yeah. People will put up a scuff over that. That is the,
it's almost like a Chicago rite of passage in a way.
Exactly. So, right. What didn't they see in that? Secondly is that I think that he should have been more flexible, and George Lucas should have been more flexible in seeing another site. That at the end of the day, what's the win for Chicago? If a guy's going to come from New York or China, we talked about this, or whatever, the fact that it said 12th in the lake or 13th in the lake or 23rd in the lake at McCormick, at Michael Reese.
Yeah, right.
He's already here in Chicago.
It's a difference. There's a difference between like putting in Southworks or putting in Waukegan or whatever.
Exactly.
That's an hour and a half. That's an hour. That's a ways away. But we're only talking about
less than a mile, right? Between right. the two, or about a mile between the two. So I think that when this thing, should have made sure the site was bulletproof before he did anything. When he found out that it wasn't bulletproof, he should have been more flexible, and Lucas should have been more flexible about looking for another site. Now, again, I think as a task force member, we picked the right site. But again, what do you want to walk away with at the end of the day? No museum, which is what we got now, or at least a museum someplace else.
I mean, you were part of that Soldier Field. You were when you worked for Mayor Daley, the Soldier Field renovation was a big part of what you. Hey, welcome to the job. Here's what you're going to do.
Exactly.
Turn this in.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But in that there were lawsuits and there were fights and the Friends of the Park were involved. So for you, I mean, even being a task force member, you had to know that was on the horizon because you're only a couple hundred feet south of where that fight was.
Exactly. And the difference being with Soldier Field, there was a building already there, but Soldier Field was a publicly owned building. The Chicago Park District owns that building. The Bears are a tenant. That's the kind of approach that could have been at least investigated.
And there's precedent.
With the Lucas thing, that the Park District builds the building. It's our building. It's a public building. Lucas, you program it. You do whatever. Park District doesn't tell the Bears who to play, how to play,
but
what to do.
But does this just go back to and this is all speculate. I don't know. But it's like it feels to me like there wasn't a spirit of compromise in the city and with George Lucas, where it was almost like, this is what I want. Make it happen. And that sort of is if what you're talking about, this compromise or changing the way that it was initially thought to be, could have saved it as opposed to ram it down the throats and let's get it done.
And this is where politics is an art and not a science. You do want to defend the site that you think is the great site, right? But then there's got to be something there. You got to have a little give, right? But I think that all the blame does not rest with Rahm. I think a pox on everybody's house. I think Lucas was wrong by not, again, explaining what this museum was, not getting out there and defending it and being inflexible on another site. And I think Friends of the Parks, while in the spirit of the law was right, the letter of the law was right in what they're doing, the spirit of the law, I think it fails. Because, again, we're going to be stuck with no new grass,
right.
No new parkland, and we actually threw away parkland which would have come as a partner to this museum.
Now, you know, one thing that I can't, it has, we talk about politics, the relationship between advocacy groups like Friends of the Park and the city of Chicago and the mayor, mm-hmm. they seem to be somewhat contentious.
They should be.
How much of it is they just don't trust the mayor, they don't trust the city, they're not going to be looking for compromises on the site because at the end of the day, they've had a history where the city's been like, look over here, bam, got mm-hmm. you with the mm-hmm. other hand. You know, So, I mean, to their credit, they hung tough even in the face of the city trying to put this strange, I've never seen it, Lee, strange marketing campaign to discredit Friends of the Park.
Yeah,
that was really weird the way that, and I know that they'll say, no, those were people, but there was forces behind the sort of, you know, protesting Friends of the Park headquarters and things like that, which is a weird thing for me to see.
You know, it really is. And, you know, they didn't publicly protest the merits of the suit. They didn't tell the public, this suit is funky, and here's the reason why. They discredited the people who filed the suit, which to me, frankly, did leave a bad taste in my mouth. This is why I think, you know, there's no innocent party in this whole thing. I know there's a sense of saying, okay, well, who's the bad guy in all of this? Who's the bad actor in all of this? There's a desire as Americans for us to see that.
Yeah.
But they're all bad actors. And they're all good actors at the same time. This is the complexity about this thing that I find both fascinating and frustrating.
And that's a great way to put it. Fascinating and frustrating. Because even as a Chicagoan, there is a sense of pride that something didn't get shoved down somebody's throat without looking. Mm-hmm. And it's also a sense of frustration in the way that the city, this could have been good for the city, and it was blocked because of sort of an old philosophy.
Yeah, old way of doing things. And, you know, this sort of the thing also frustrated me was the end game when, you know, the idea was, we are going to not spend a public dime on this thing. So Lucas, here's your site, you built the thing on your own dime, which is great. $743 million. We get essentially not a free museum, but we get a museum that we don't have to pay for the cost of, right? And then to save the thing, when the suit goes on, the mayor is willing to, you know, figure out this other plan in which he would demolish old McCormick Place,
and
build a museum on the foundations, build another convention center decking Lakeshore Drive to replace the space lost to McCormick Place, and find extend $1.3 billion in new taxes.
And have to deal with the state.
And you know, what is that? It's a Hail Mary. You know, it's worse than a Hail Mary. But on the other hand, you know, if there were $1.3 million on the table, McCormick Place, I mean, Michael Reese would have been a great site. That money could have paid off the debt.
That's a great point.
You know,
if there was money available, if the city was willing to invest in a McCormick Place site, why not take that money and invest somewhere else?
Exactly.
And I think that's what a lot of Chicagoans want.
For half that amount, I mean, we could have taken, I mean, just make up a number, $700 million, paid off the note that the city owns in McCormick Place, which I think is around $100 million, and then $600 million in public funds for infrastructure improvements, and Lucas can build his museum on top of that. Had we known, had that been part of the thing, which gets to a thing, which is why I never work in the city again, we need urban planning in this city. And urban planners and urban planning, all those questions are asked. What's the best place to put it from an urban planning perspective? We did a good job, I think.
Let's take a break for the news. But I'm interested because maybe there is a need for, I guess, what we would consider to be, I don't want to be so grandiose, but a new Burnham plan that just gives Chicago an understanding of what the next century is going to look like.
We do.
The Bay Plan?
The Bay Plan. This city will be on fire.
Can I get initial in there? The Bay K? Can we get it together? All right. Lee Bay, architecture contributor here on The Download with me tonight. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. And we got to talk Ebony Jet, too.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't get a chance to talk about that news that came out. I wanted to talk about not just the media side of it, but there's an architecture part of that story as well. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Lee Bay, regular here, architecture contributor. He's worked in several different places, including his blog, Beyond the Boat Tour, one of my favorite blogs of all time.
Back in the old days.
Also worked for, was a columnist at the Sun-Times, and he worked in, was it the planning department?
Mayor's office.
Mayor's office. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mayor Daley.
That's right. Work for the man directly.
Before we move on to some other stories in architecture, the one thought I had, because there was a big piece that the Tribune did about this project, the Lucas Museum, now is added to a list of projects that never came about.
Oh, yeah.
Spire is one. Mm-hmm. You know, the hole that's still there and people trying to figure out. I think they talked about, I want to say it was a harbor project. I can't remember what it was, but there was some, there was like three or four projects in Chicago history that...
Oh, look. There are something like 200 projects in Chicago history that, and I know this because I was going to write a book about this once, that got through approval processes. I'm not talking about pie in the sky. I'm going to build a copy of the Eiffel Tower on 61st and Eberhard. I mean, like, things that got through the planning process that somehow fell apart. But it's a funny, so Millennium Park is probably a good example. So Millennium Park, what's now open in 2004 as Millennium Park, was even in the days of Daniel Burnham and just after, was supposed to be an open space for people to be at. In the 60s and 70s, it was going to be called Lakefront Gardens. I can show you renderings of it with a band show, all the elements we see today. So a good idea, the good news about this, if there's any good news, is that a good idea ultimately finds currency. As, you know, converting Meigs Field, how it was done, still a controversy.
But politics is an art. Exactly, that's what you said, right?
Converting Meigs Field to open space. Talked about for 30 years. Finally happened in the middle of the night with X's on the runway. So the good ideas almost always find currency.
Where do we see the Lucas Museum in the history of failed projects? Will it be remembered? Will Chicagoans go, oh, the history, the Lucas Museum boondoggle?
We'll forget about it. We always do. For instance, we were in the running to get the United Nations here. It was going to go on Northerly Island back in the 40s, and we were in the mix. I can show you documents of it. New York got it. And we're like, okay, cool. That's the one thing about the city. You know, as much as I criticize it, I love it. You know, I was born here. Is that there's no city in America that can shake off a loss and dunk on you like Chicago can. So that's the one.
Great.
We'll survive this. A lot of people are saying, and I've said it was a loss, but it's not a fatal loss. We'll get beyond this. We'll get beyond this in 3 weeks. A month, whatever. But that's the one thing we do well.
When Gene Roddenberry's museum comes to town,
the Battlestar Galactica Museum. That's what I'm looking for, man. With you know, Richard Hatch and Dirk Benedict.
We didn't get a chance to talk about Ebony Jet. I mean, this is not a media segment, but Ebony Jet announced that they're selling to an Austin, Texas-based company. Mm-hmm. Ebony Jet, long-time media company, Chicago-owned, the Johnson Company. I mean, everywhere down the line, I mean, African-American publication that's historic, decades old. But the other story, which I think is interesting, is coincidentally the building, which has architectural significance here in Chicago, is also on the block. But that building's no longer owned by Ebony Jet.
Exactly. Columbia College bought it, our alma mater, bought it, around 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, and with the idea that it would preserve it. This is 820 South Michigan. Turn into a media center that was named not like a library, in a media center named in honor of John and Eunice Johnson. They preserved some of the original stuff, which is really wild. The original interior still from the 70s, still maintained. They got a new president in Warwick Carter, the old president, left. New president, financial problems to deal with, and this became less of a priority. So now they're putting on the block. They bought it for $8 million. They'll get that easily or more. The concern for those who like preservation or the preservation of Black history and architectural preservation is that it's an 11-story building, so it's undersized for its site. So just to give you an example, down the street, one block south on this down the street, Helmut Jahn was proposing an 800-foot skyscraper, 800 and some change foot skyscraper, 70 stories, I think, or more. This one has 11. So the idea, so you can build very large. So the question is, now they're putting it for sale, what's going to happen to it? Can they? And will the city's landmark mechanism jump in because of any building in Chicago, pioneering Black architect, building a building for a pioneering Black publisher, cultural maker, and American? If any building is worth landmark status, that's the one.
Does the city landmarking apparatus, as you just mentioned, does it have teeth? Does it have muscle, kind of like Friends of the Park did in this situation? Could it come in and say, no way, man, you can't do anything
with
this?
It can grant preliminary landmark status at its next meeting if it does the research and chooses to.
Do you think it's worth it? Do you think that building's worth it?
I think it is. I think not only that, I think it's worthy of the trifecta. Chicago Landmark, National Historic Landmark, and National Register of Historic Places. It's that important. And, once that happens, city landmark status, you can't get a demolition permit pulled on it, and you have to maintain the building to agreed-upon standards. So
now I'd imagine Columbia College would fight that because they want to sell it. That'd be an interesting. That's
it
interesting.
Would be. It really would be, yeah.
Oh, interesting. They'd be on the wrong side of they're in art school.
Well, they sure would.
That's
my alumni check won't cash. I'll tell you that.
You're going to go down a rung to like $25 instead of the $75 that
or
you usually give them?
Bucks,
zero, right?
Yeah.
I'm interested, the one thing about Ebony Jet, which is they have a tremendous archive, and they've been trying to sell the archive. That was a story last year that they put the archive on the market. You could buy pictures, and people were upset about that because you're losing this huge collection. That didn't sell like they wanted it to. But for you as a photographer, as someone who obviously a history buff and into architecture, the idea of selling an archive, how do you feel about that?
It depends on who it's sold to. I wish that a university could buy it and open it up and make it. There's this archive that Indiana University has of a guy named George Cushman. He was here for a while. He took thousands of photos of Chicago and other places, and he did it on Kodachrome film back in the 30s. So you get a chance to see Chicago the way it used to look in color. We usually see pictures in black and white. They've made these, you can search them, you can look at them, you can do everything but own them, and you probably could buy them. But they're open to the public. You can see them all. They're not turning up in Gap commercials or anything like that. So the idea is that it's a gift to the public. This is the kind of approach I wish a university in Chicago would do. Mm-hmm. I wish Chicago State University, pioneering, black university in Chicago, public university, I wish they could do it. I wish University of Chicago could possibly do it.
Yeah, right.
That would be the thing. So, the selling of the archive isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's who ends up with it. The picture of Coretta Scott Davis, Coretta Scott King, at the Martin Luther King's funeral with her daughter in her lap, Juanita Sleet's, Pulitzer Prize winning picture. Does that, who gets that? Who gets to use that? Does it turn up one place where you don't want it, selling blue jeans or whatever? Or does it, or is it right in the public realm the way it needs to be and respected the way the image needs
to be? It's interesting. It's preserving history. It's preserving legacy. But also, this is art. The photograph you mentioned just now, that's unbelievable, iconic American art.
It is. So in Liebe's perfect world, perhaps millionaire steps in, buys it, and gifts it to the DeSable Museum, to the Art Institute, to someone who can treat this valuable collection the right way.
I saw on Facebook today you took an awesome picture of Lake Point Tower.
Thank you.
And you mentioned, you said it still holds up.
It still holds up.
And we're talking about the building that's right in front of Navy Pier, I guess it is, where the elite live in Chicago. But what is it about that building that still holds up?
We think of Measian architecture in Chicago, like square boxes, IBM building, Illinois Center, these kind of things. Here, two Mies students, George Shipwright, the late George Shipwright, he died a couple years ago, and his partner John Heinrich, took the Measian box and they gave it sexy curves. They based it on one of Mies' old unbuilt designs from the 20s, from before he got here. But the building is sexy. It's tall. It's sensuous. It's curved, and it sits there aloof on the lake by itself.
Yeah, it's so weird that it is by itself.
It is. Now the reason why that is, why we can't build east of Lakeshore Drive, which is the topic of the first part of this.
Right. That was going to bring
this
full
circle. This was private land owned by the old Chicago Dock and Canal Company that happened to be east of Lakeshore Drive. They had property west, but they had this jut that stuck out in the lake, and even then it was controversial for the day, but that's how they were able to do it. It wasn't parkland. It was never publicly owned.
So for everyone listening, when we say lakefront, it has to be essentially parkland, or
that you can't build on. And almost all of the lakefront in this city is parkland.
Are there any other, I'm going to put you on the spot, but are there any other situations where there is stuff that's been built on the lakefront that is private that we can think of besides Lake Point Tower?
That's really it. Now, when you get further south, past the South Shore Cultural Center, and maybe a little bit further north, I think, past Hollywood, you get these things where buildings stop at the lake.
I think about Edgewater, like the, all those high rises that are along Sheridan Road there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I've never, I hate to say, sorry, Northsiders, I've never peeked behind those buildings to see if there's any parkland behind all that. So if there is, I'm sorry.
I think there. I think I haven't.
But
yeah,
the city
either.
Owns from the water from the water's from the edge of the water into infinity. There are things called riparian rights. So there's actually, you can find maps, but there's actually grids of streets under there, unbuilt streets. The city is sticking its claim saying, don't build in this water because we're going to come back for it one day. There's even a plan to kind of do that, to extend the lakeshore and the lakeshore park that was part of the Lucas Museum deal at the last minute.
Well, I think we're on to something. I think that the Bay Plan is the I know you don't like the name.
That's right.
You
that's
do
right.
like the name. You just have to you have to have some humility.
That's right.
But
that's right.
I know.
Somewhere again.
Right. You have a huge smile on your face. But the I wonder if that could be a way that we could move forward this summer. Could have you back on and we could talk about some of the issues and almost have discourse about urban planning and what we see we include the WGN audience here. On what we could see Chicago being in the next 50 to 100 years.
Love to.
Right?
Absolutely love to. Because it's a question that has to be asked. If we don't plan it, it'll always be like this. I got an idea. This guy wants to do this. If we don't plan it, Burnham taught us that. Daley the First taught us that. Daley the Second, to a certain extent, taught us that. If we don't plan it and leave it to chance and happenstance, you'll get these kind of crazy fits and starts.
Lee Bay is an architecture contributor. He's a photographer. He's a all-around Renaissance man.
Thank you.
Where can we find your work? Where are you centrally located? Facebook now?
It seems like it's Facebook now, but also leebay.com has some of my stuff. And also, if you look up Urban Observer, it's a blog. I put some commentary and photography there.
Always a pleasure to see you, bud.
Same here, man.
The Bay Plan. Ooh, I like it.
Like that. Mm-hmm.
I feel like this is just part of my life as both being someone who is in media but also does comedy, that I'm like, that's a great bit. And I'm like, no, it's a great thing to be serious about. Or is it a great thing to be funny about? There's so much you could do in an urban plan. What does Chicago need? Real funny. Real made up. Yeah, but I think that'd be great. It's kind of like, I mean, it'd be nice to figure out a way to do that in a, find a sexy way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Urban planning.
Say it like that. That's it's a first step.
Coming up tonight, urban planning. I think Lee's got it though. I mean, if we're going to plan ahead in some form, have a better understanding of the city we live in and what we want our priorities to be. There's only one way to do that. And that is to sort of start talking about what we want. And I think if anything, we elect officials in this town to be our mayors and our aldermen or representatives. But you know what? It might have to be something that's done citywide for us to actually think about our future. As we're seeing, you get into a certain situation where elected officials, for whatever reason, determine they're the ones that are going to do it without any planning. We're going to shove this down your throat. Or we're going to vote this through without any sort of talk about it. I mean, that's that, you know, those days of governing seem to be gone for us. And I think that Chicago is to a point now where I think people who live here want a stake in it and they want to figure out how we're going to keep this city vibrant. And it is vibrant. I have to say, I was out in Chicago. I was in Wicker Park on Saturday night. Actually, during the day. It was daytime. It was like, yeah, I know, right? How about it? 11 o'clock, maybe. I went over to Stan's Donuts.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Then just walked up to 606, as Lee was talking. I'd never been up there. And I stopped at one point when I was on Milwaukee, donut in hand, and I looked down Milwaukee, and I was just like, this city is, like, alive. It was hot on Saturday, but there was this, it was New York City-like.
Yeah, people are everywhere.
There were just so many people. There were hundreds and hundreds of people everywhere. Vibrant businesses, people in and out, lines out the door at the Walgreens, you know? And I thought in my head about the comparison to some other cities who have fallen on hard times. And they're always like, well, Chicago's going to be next. And maybe there's something to that, especially when it comes to the financial situation. But you don't see that on the street here. You see a city that is getting bigger and more popular. And people want to be here. Younger people want to be here. So we got to start thinking about what the next generation holds, as opposed to just piecemealing, putting Band-Aids on and paving over parking lots to put up other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's something to that, especially when we saw, and I thought Lee nailed it, and I never thought of this before, and I would have used this in my arguments with Roe. But the idea that there was money floated at the last minute, money, you know, at the tune of 700 or more than that, like $1 billion or something, to renovate McCormick Place to be able to put the museum there. Where was the money, if there was always going to be money on the table,
mm-hmm.
where's the money to retrofit Michael Reese Hospital?
Yeah.
Or a space that's not the lakefront? So you had the money, or at least you thought, you know, you were talking about
mm-hmm.
you were going to figure out a way to politically use that money. You just, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. that to me is a head scratcher in the way that there probably could have been if Rahm Emanuel was looking to save that project and he threw out a huge chunk of money for McCormick Place to essentially tear that down and build the Lucas Museum, then why not use some of that money and political muscle somewhere else if it was available? I don't know. Thoughts. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, White Mystery is here. A dynamic duo. Yeah. I wonder if they probably used that. I hope they've used that. The brother-sister duo. It's been all over. I mean, interesting. They're so prolific.
Yeah.
They bust on the scene in 2008. And I remember when they came on. They played a lot of festivals. They played the Riot Fests and the Pitchforks, things like that. And they've essentially, I got to fact check this, but I think they've put out a record a year.
Yeah, it seems like it.
I mean, they've done, I think this is their eighth one they just put out this year, Out of Control. So they're going to perform live in studio, which is great. They're a really great kind of rock and roll duo. It's just sort of like, I like that.
Should be fun.
Yeah, right? I feel bad that Bob doesn't have like 9 horns to deal with tonight. That's the only thing that I'm upset. I feel like he's not being challenged.
He's
proven himself.
I haven't told Bob yet of the 7-Eleven plan. We're like,
we haven't told him?
We haven't told him yet.
Should we tell him right now on the air so he loves it? Talking about two bands. Yeah. We're talking, well, it's the week, the before July 11th, or before that week is the week of Pitchfork. And we have a unbelievable opportunity to get two of the bands that are playing Pitchfork to perform live on the show. Come on. Problem is that there's two of them. So we got to figure out how to do that. So we'll talk with Bob Ferguson, our audio engineer, who does the mixing on the show. So we've already got him running ragged on one band.
If it wasn't somebody that wasn't as skilled as Bob, I would never even talk about it. But, you know, I can know that he can handle the 7-piece band number one.
It's the challenge factor. It's just like I said, I feel bad. I mean, White Mystery is a big deal to be here. That's great. But, you know, it's two of them. You know, Bob, I'm thinking we get some gospel choirs in here. Mukapatsa, when they come in later in the summer, the marching band here in the Fishbowl.
That's going to be great.
Studio 435. All right, we'll take a break here. When we come back with the news, after the news, White Mystery live in Studio 435. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock, and Patty Vasquez, pretty late with Patty Vasquez, takes over. Well, it's time for Studio 435, a regular Monday night segment that brings you live performances from some of Chicago's best musicians. Tonight's no exception. We bring you the sounds of White Mystery, the rock and roll duo, brother-sister combo of Miss Alex White and Francis Scott Key White. The band has put out an album a year since they started playing together in 2008. Their latest is Out of Control. And it's called Out of Control. See what I did there? White Mystery is playing the Edgewater Greek Fest at St. Andrew's Church on July 9th. And they have a warehouse show coming up as well. We'll talk about that. And they're in studio with us right now. Ladies and gentlemen, White Mystery.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Falling in love on the tip of a rocket. Put that in your dream and smoke it. Well, I can be nice and naughty. Well, I can be proud of my body, yeah. You are my best friend. You're my best friend. You are my best friend.
You're my best friend.
Falling in love on the tip of a rocket. Put that in your dream and smoke it. I can be nice and naughty. I can be proud of my body, yeah. You are my best friend. You're my best friend. You are my best friend.
You're my best friend.
You my best friend.
You're my best friend. Yeah.
White Mystery in studio here in Studio 435 in the Allstate's Showcase Studio. I said the word studio six times. I miss Alex White, Francis Scott Key White in studio with us tonight. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us in your studio.
The studio. The song called Best Friend off the record, Out of Control. Let's talk about that. I mentioned at the beginning, I mean, you guys have been performing together since 2008, and you put out an album a year, essentially. Talk about how you guys make music and how fast you make music.
Well, as brother and sister, we've been playing together since we were little kids, and White Mystery formally started in 2008. And that's when we decided that we would be a band for 10 years, put a record out like clockwork on April 20th every year. And since then, we've played almost 1,000 shows worldwide in Japan and the UK. And it keeps us motivated to have that cycle of productivity. And we even put out a feature-length film last year. It pushes us to be really creative as a band.
Is that important to you? Is that important to have deadlines and to be able to produce in that kind of pressure?
Absolutely. It keeps you on track, keeps you fit artistically and physically, and pushes you out there beyond your comfort levels. And at this point, we're on our way to a Guinness record, so it worked out.
There you go. Talk about the relationship you guys playing together as siblings. What are the benefits of, you know, being able to play music as White Mystery with someone you've played with your entire life?
100% trust and dedication is a definite benefit of having a blood relative as your bandmate.
Too blessed to be stressed. And we're very grateful to all of our fans and friends and family who have supported us all these years, especially our mom and dad. Thanks, mom and dad.
At least if you get up there on stage to accept awards, just one set of parents that you have to thank. That works out.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's talk about Out of Control. To be able to do 8 albums, you know, how do you feel about the evolution of the work, of the music? Talk about sort of, you know, how your music has changed and matured over the 8 albums time.
Well, we've been calling the new White Mystery album Out of Control our pop masterpiece, where our first several albums, we kicked them out in a day. Just very punk rock, You know, sat down, nailed an entire album, mixed it the following day. Without a control, we had the luxury of time. So we were able to really develop the songs, make each one unique.
Did you like that? You like that, yeah?
Well, you know, what's cool about this April 20th cycle and being Chicagoans, lifelong Chicago Public School, you know, people from the North Side, is that we usually have to record in the wintertime. You know, if it's hard to remember now that it's gorgeous outside, but when we have those snowy, insane, just bone-chilling days, that's when we record our records. So it, like we were saying, it keeps us productive, and it's definitely something to do in the depths of the winter. And Out of Control does have like a sunny vibe, though. We had fun with it. And it goes anywhere from Best Friend, the song that you just heard now, to darker songs like Sweet Relief, which we're going to play for you later.
We're talking with the band White Mystery in studio with Ms. Alex White and Francis Scott Key White. They're playing at the Edgewater Greek Fest at the St. Andrew's Church on July 9th. They also have a warehouse show coming up. We'll talk about that in a minute. Let's take a break. We'll come back here at Studio 435. We'll hear some more music.
Woo-hoo.
Stay with us. It's Studio 435 time here on The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, White Mystery, Miss Alex White and Francis Scott Key White, the dynamic duo of siblings, brother and sister combo, grew up here in Chicago, and they're playing the Edgewater Greek Fest at St. Andrew's Church on July 9th. But they've played, I mean, they tour all over the country, played all over the world, festivals here in Chicago like Riot Fest and on and on and on. So great to have you guys in studio. I've been a fan of yours. I've known your work here in Chicago for years. I mean, it's amazing to think that you guys just started as White Mystery in 2008. It feels like it's much longer.
Well, that feels like a lifetime ago now, 2008, after having played almost 1,000 shows on 3 continents, 44 states. A lot of people recognize us from playing on that parade float with Sir Richard Branson last year. And that
for
Ferris
the Virgin
Bueller.
Hotel, right?
Yeah. You know, so in that time, we have just seen so much and experienced so much, but we're always happy to come back to Chicago, to our roots.
Well, talk about that. I mean, for you, I mean, upwards of 200, 250 shows a year, touring everywhere around the world. I mean, and you're an independent, you guys book everything yourselves. So talk about that. How satisfying has it been to be able to be White Mystery and tour the world?
It's amazing to own your own success, to be responsible for your own failures, but also all the things, the great heights that you can achieve. We have 100% responsibility outside of our family that's helped us and our friends that have provided, you know, beds and food for us along the way. It's been Alex and I every single step, and it's been a wild adventure. And it was also our destiny since we were small children to go out and accomplish this. So, I don't know, it's pretty cool.
As you know, brother, sister, talk about your roots in music. Where did it come from that you guys were drawn to being musicians?
Well, neither one of our parents are musicians, but they're music lovers. So, you know, in the 90s, when people were repurchasing their vinyl collections on compact disc, we got to hear the Rolling Stones and the Who and all of these great bands that really helped us fall in love with rock and roll. There's a picture of Francis and I when we're wee little kids in our first band called Baby Blues, predating the cartoon. We were like, hey, wait, that's our name. And we saw that Tribune comic, actually. And Fran's playing a little plastic piano, and I'm playing a saxophone. And, you know, it's just being raised in a creative household where our mom was like, turn up the vocals instead of turn down, you know, turn it down, down there. She was always very encouraging. And because of that, we were totally cool with taking the reins on this band. I graduated from DePaul University with a business degree in entrepreneurship. Started a record label when I was in high school at Northside College Prep up on the north side of Chicago. And it's just been cool developing this project and developing the vision and putting these records out and designing the covers. And now we're at a point where we're collaborating with a lot of artists who are creating these covers and these posters and these videos, which are all on our website, whitemystery.com. And it's just cool that you could start in your parents' basement and then end up on late-night television.
Yeah, right. I mean, for you guys, I mean, talk about that collaborative spirit, because the two of you have paved a way and carved out success together. as White Mystery, the duo, as you get bigger and there's more opportunity for collaboration, whether it be videos or whether it be other musicians. I mean, how do you open up to bring other people into the White Mystery family?
I think a lot of times those people approach us. We're, for instance, a poster artist from Indonesia. We still haven't met him personally, of course, but through email, I guess the internet is a huge part of being able to be connected worldwide and set up these tours, where maybe 50 years ago, a band could not have necessarily booked themselves in the UK and across Europe because the internet has become such a connected tool for
GPS
an entrepreneur.
Technology.
Yeah.
Cell phone technology, not having to rely on payphones and phone books and handwritten maps and the generosity of strangers to get across the world. It's a big,
it's a big
leg up nowadays, you know?
Yeah.
I know that. I remember being in a touring, I think I was in a weird, like in somewhere in Wales. I just got on a payphone and I had a phone number on the back of a thing. And I called somebody who was a friend of a friend in London. They're like, yeah, come on through tonight. I'm a shoo. Oh, man. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is a little different now. Like, that was pre-internet days.
There's still high-risk, high-reward moments where you don't know where you're going next and the places you came from was pretty sketchy the night before and it gets kind of gnarly, but we have each other no matter what and we don't split up.
Yeah, stick together for all those bands out there who are like, well, how do you do it? How do you accomplish all this? Just stick together.
Yeah.
And back
because
each other
there
up.
Are, I mean, there's ups and downs, and there's going to be a lot of different challenges. Does it hinder you at all, or the challenges, the fact that you are family? I know if I was on tour with my brother, I think we'd be in fights every third day.
I always think of what Buddy Guy told us when we had an interview with him years ago, where he asked who does the driving, and I was like, I do a lot of the driving. And he said, do you ever hit a bump in the road? And I said, yes. And he's like, well, just keep driving. What do you do when you hit a bump in the road? You don't stop. You got to just keep going. And Alex and I took that advice to heart a long time ago and knew it wouldn't always just be an easy ride, but I don't know. Perseverance is key.
Love it. All right. White Mystery in studio, Studio 435 here. Let's hear another track. What do you guys want to play?
We're going to play a song called Cerebellum off the new record about parts of the brain.
Cerebellum. All right. White Mystery in studio here on Michigan Avenue. Take it away.
1, 2, 3, 4.
I don't know how I'm gonna tell him that I've got no cerebellum. He's coming after me. But you know that I'm no sissy. In the morning light, you know I'm gonna be there. In the morning, in the starry sky, you know I'm gonna be there. Ooh, bow, bow, ooh, bow, 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 ooh, bow, bow, ooh, bow, 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 ooh, bow, bow, ooh, bow, 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 bow. Gonna be there. Mama Dula on Blangada. If you want some, I got a lighter. He's coming after me. But you know that I'm no sissy. In the morning light, you know I'm gonna be there. In the morning, in the starry sky, you know I'm gonna be there. Ooh, bow, bow. Ooh, bow, 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 bow. Ooh, bow, bow. Ooh, bow, 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 bow. Ooh, bow, bow. Ooh, bow, 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 bow. I'm gonna be there. Inside my humble abode, where you find my frontal lobe. He's coming after me, but you know that I'm no sissy. In the morning light, you know I'm gonna see. got a finger in my cortex. He's waiting at my doorstep. Why does he want my gray matter? That's the sound of children's laughter. In the morning light, you know I'm gonna be there. In the morning, in the starry sky, you know I'm gonna be there. Ooh, bow, bow. Ooh, bow, 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 bow. Ooh, bow, bow. Ooh, bow, 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 bow. Ooh, bow, bow. Ooh, bow, 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 bow. I'm gonna be there.
Yeah, all right. There we go. White Mystery in studios, Studio 435 here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. They're playing Edgewater Greek Fest at St. Andrew's Church on July 9th. Their new album is called Out of Control. We'll continue here with Studio 435. Gets one last track with White Mystery after the news here in the Download. Stay with us. It's a Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's Studio 435 Monday nights. This is where we have our Monday night segment that bring you the live performances from some of Chicago's greatest. Tonight's no exception. We're bringing you the sounds of White Mystery, the rock and roll duo, the brother-sister combo of Miss Alex White and Francis Scott Key White. They've got their latest album, Out of Control, is out this year. They've done pretty much an album a year since they became White Mystery back in 2008. They're playing the Edgewater Greek Fest at St. Andrew's Church on July 9th and a warehouse show as well, which doesn't have a location yet. That's the fun part about a warehouse show, right?
Yeah, this is one of our signature mystery shows coming up this weekend, and the address will be announced the day of the show.
Really?
Yep.
So just follow on social media. Is that pretty much where you find it?
That's the way to do it.
All right. Follow White Mystery. You guys, you mentioned early on, and it caught this, and I didn't know this, but you said, you know, it's a 10-year project.
Yes.
White Mystery is a 10-year project. So 2018 is the completion of a decade's worth of music.
Right.
What's the plan? I mean, is the plan to break up, to not work together? What? Why just a 10-year limit?
It started off where 10 years felt really far away when we first set up that goal. And it guided us through, you know, sticking together, touring, aggressively producing albums, and now, you know, 2018's around the corner, and what happens next will be the mystery.
For you, and Francis, you mentioned this in an interview about the idea of really committing to this project. I mean, when you talk about committing, that means not just, you know, playing in this band, but putting a hold on relationships, being in a position where the music comes first. Talk about that concept, that philosophy when being in a band, that especially a band with your sister.
Well, in order to visualize something, to bring something into reality that you have in your head or your heart or a dream, you have to really pour your essence into it to make it real, and sometimes put on hold like who you are for who you may turn into in the future. And it's been like an incubation period for the last 8 years, and we're going to metamorphosize into something the world's never seen before. So just hold on to your pants, you know.
Well, that's good. I didn't see that coming at the end of that answer. That's good. There's going to be a metamorphosis. But, I mean, for you, I mean, how important is it, you know, and there is this, especially when you're talking about being independent musician in Chicago, there's this give and take where, you know, people will have day jobs or do things for money and then be able to do music on the side. I just read something today about a longtime musician who said music, unfortunately, as I got older, became a hobby. Mm-hmm. You know, like other things became my full-time ventures. Talk about that push and pull of being an artist, especially an artist in Chicago, where you have to think about, you know, paying the rent as opposed to just being a pure musician.
We very much decided early on that music wasn't going to be a hobby. And we have 50 or 60 years of rock and roll history to learn from up until this point. And there was a way of doing things for a long time that my sister didn't believe in. So we didn't start paying for rent in a practice space like most bands do. And we didn't sign away pieces of every single check like a lot of bands do. And we decided to just persevere, even though at the time it felt like we were doing things in a way that no one else really was. And that can be scary, but you have to take risks in order to get a reward, and our mom told us to not come back home until we were famous, so we went on tour for 5 years. And 8 years, quit our day jobs, took that risk where if it didn't work out, we might have starved or ended up somewhere in the world lost and not be able to get back. But we did it, and we're here, and we're not done yet.
We were on tour for so long, we came home and our dog's hair was gray. We're like, wow, it's been a long ride. This poor dog. And then you look in the mirror and you realize that you're exactly the also. Same. That rock and roll keeps you young, for sure.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, you mentioned it, DePaul University, having a background and getting a degree in going to business school.
Yes.
Talk about how that informs your music. I mean, do you, obviously, by doing things that are a little bit different, persevering, doing the things that Francis was just talking about, that's born not just from sort of, hey, we're just going to do this because we're musicians. It's born from a background in business.
Right. And, you know, the way that it started when I was going to Northside College Prep on the north side of Chicago, started a record label when I was 17, started putting out 7-inch 45s, little tiny vinyl platters. And one day my mom said, did you know that what you do is called entrepreneurship? And I had never heard that term before. And she handed me a Chicago Tribune article about how DePaul was one of the first universities to offer an undergrad entrepreneurship program. So with that in mind, I pursued it and was able to use my record label as my case study throughout my college experience. And with that, I was able to really develop it in that time. So when White Mystery was ready to launch, I had figured out worldwide distribution and licensing and reading contracts and all that business. And like Fran said, it was kind of scary at first, where it's like, okay, it's us against the world a little bit. And you think about the Illuminati and, oh man, are they after us? What's going on? That sort of thing. side note. But what we found is that while it's a slower start, and there were a lot of bands that shot past us at that beginning stage.
You had a plan.
We had a plan, and we're still banned, where a lot of bands have come and gone in that period of time. And what it's really about is dedication to each other and White Mystery as a third-party entity.
I'm fascinated by the concept of, you know, merging music and business school. You know, there's this idea of book smart and street smart. How much, you know, did you have in your mind about, you know, the concept and the plan that you wanted White Mystery to be, and how much has that changed as you got on the road and you started to live the life of White Mystery?
We stuck to it 100%, and we've been unwavering up until this point, and that's why, I don't know, I feel like it works, and we're still a band, and we haven't given up on each other yet.
Goal setting is essential. So at the beginning of this band, one of our first goals was, let's play Canada. That'll be our second country. We can say we've played two countries. And once we did Canada, we played Canada two times. Then we said, okay, let's play Europe. You know, and then within a year or two, you've accomplished that. And then you've gone back a second time. And what we realize is that when we set goals, we were doubling up on them. And when we said we have to play a third continent, we have to tour Japan, we accomplished that goal last year, and it was one of the wildest, best feelings to be halfway across the world, on the other side of the globe, planet Earth, and playing for people in Nagoya and Fukuoka and Tokyo.
What goals haven't been crossed off the list?
We have not played Conan O'Brien yet. We played the Carson Daly Show on NBC. That was our first late-night foray TV appearance. And
but Conan's on the big list.
Conan, he's our fellow redhead. We're two gingers. We want to play for Conan.
Okay.
Yeah.
And performing at the Aragon Ballroom, where at first, like 6 years ago, I was like, wow, I'd love to play the Metro. If I played the Metro, that means I made it. And then you play the Metro a couple times, and you think, what's next? It's like, wow, the Aragon's just sort of lingering in the distance. Are we ever going to be able to get in there and like play a show, play a packed show? So we're working on it for 2018. We're going to take a good 2 years to plan out a good show before we're done, you know.
The last question is just about Chicago. You've mentioned, you know, both went to high school here. You grew up here. You went to high school in Chicago. You went to DePaul. Talk about what this town means to you as musicians to say that you're Chicago's white mystery.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago is such an important part to our cultural fabric and our identities. You know, you can leave here, but you still have Chicago inside of you, and that's a toughness and street smarts, which you're describing. But it's also that industrial din of cars and the L tracks just clattering away.
Fireworks and gunshots.
Yeah, unfortunately. But I feel like we're a loud band, and we're a little bit of we've got a little dirt around the edges of what we play, and that's very Chicago.
White Mystery is going to be playing at the Edgewater Greek Fest at St. Andrew's Church on July 9th. They've also got a warehouse show coming up this weekend, but you got to go on their social media to find out where it's going to be. That'll be on Saturday?
Yes.
Saturday. The album is called Out of Control. Can we hear one more from you guys?
Yes.
This is Francis's special song. It's called Sweet Relief.
Sweet Relief by White Mystery in studio here, Studio 435. Take it away, guys.
Sweetness is a weakness, you're gonna wanna see this through the pain and the sickness. I have the thickest equipment, you know I'll make the shipment just in time for Christmas. You won't wanna miss this, get back in line and go about your business. It's the meanest shiznit, this side Olympus. Get take a step back before I get this lips under this lips. Goodbye and good riddance, leave now or I'll send you back to the sticks while your body bag zips. I sneak attack with D6s and spike frauds in the tournament. Say one more word and I'll torture you with my instruments. The knee of justice shatters your ignorance, immobilize with real eyes. The forces of evil may spin their lies, but will mesmerize. Materialize the cavalry with the righteous war cries. Field of Ives may just realize how pathetic you seem to the just and the wise. Few we may be, but the lion's share of the glory marks our legacy. With my sword sister next to me, there's nothing out of reach. I'll fight in the streets with scars on my feet until the battle's won, the enemy's beat. The legend will live in the malice of subside. Maybe one day after we all die, someone will be smart enough to learn the reason why. Spirit of the generation, bring the message to our nation. When your bootstraps become your table scraps, freedom can still be found on a map. You don't know what you want, let alone how to get it. You can still find enlightenment hidden inside a real work ethic. Make you proud is my fetish. Find yourself on heaven's guest list. My destiny is supersonic. I pray to not become demonic. A twist of fate can derail a crusade if the crucible can be swayed. Invisible hands man their payment. Blood for the blood got inside the pavement. Anxiety makes you manipulate. Depression is real, but you are fake. The chemicals in our bodies are making dead suns and the ghosts of aliens. We want to be free. It's going to be excruciating to fight for all eternity. We're slaves to the lords of the galaxy who look just like you and me. We want to be free. It's going to be excruciating to fight for all eternity. Don't turn your back on me. I promise it will be haunting. Martyrs split in half air to their necks may still have an effect if the awokens don't expect it to be handed to them. You probably have rocks in your hands already. Hardwired to a system you think you can see despite your eyelids masking the true reality. The pain will rouse you from sleep. The dreams deep inside can still blind while the truth creeps out your ears in waves of disguise. Behind every soldier is a queen that resents the fate that attracted her in the first damn place. I hope we all die in outer space, cold, alone, and afraid. The oxygen leaves your body in a violent parade. The bug lord's about to get laid, and he's ready to impregnate you with the child whose mighty pincers and eight legs!
We're coming for you. You're running from me, yeah. The tables are turning. We want to be free, yeah. Oh, oh, sweet relief. We're coming for you, yeah. You're running from me, oh no. The tables are turning. We want to be free, yeah. Oh, oh, sweet relief.
You better believe we're coming for you. Climb the trees, we're gonna eat you. Looking at rays of light through a lens of blood and flesh, be my guest.
We're coming for you. You're running from me, oh yeah. The tables are turning. We want to be free, yeah. Whoa, whoa, sweet.
Yeah. In studio tonight, the band White Mystery. Thank you so much, Miss Alex White and Francis Scott Key White. You can see White Mystery playing at the Edgewater Greek Fest in St. Andrew's Church on July 9th. They also going to be playing a warehouse show this weekend. Check out their social media, White Mystery, on Facebooks and all the others, Twitter, everything in between. The new record is called Out of Control. I can't thank you guys enough. Thanks for being here, and thanks for being our guest on Studio 435.
What up? Thank you so much for having us. Shout-outs to everybody out there.
It's a download here on 720 WGN Chicago. I'm Justin Kaufman, the band White Mystery. That was great. So fun, huh, Pete?
Amazing. Love it.
I know. I did miss the drums, but the way Francis plays drums, I think they'd be calling in noise complaints over at 444 North Michigan. They're like, "What is happening across the street?" That, you know what? Okay. Just Larry, call the police. Yeah, they're too loud. Yeah, but it's great to have them here. I, you know what we need to do is have them back at the 10-year mark.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, see what's next. Maybe we'll we can work a deal. Yeah, we'll work a deal with Alex to find a way to be the, like, we'll contract it that we get to give the
announcement
mystery, whatever the mystery is.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. It'll be a tough negotiation, though. She did go to business school. All right. Coming up next, Patty Vasquez. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. Patty was the star of the parade yesterday.
Yeah, how about
it? She was so good. She jumped up on toddler. You know what? I'm gonna stop because she's got great stories to tell. That she dominated the Pride Parade yesterday. It felt pretty good to be part of her entourage.
This was my second parade for the WGN family.
Oh, nice, yeah.
And I felt the same way last year. I thought Patty Vasquez was the star of the show, and she did not disappoint.
Yeah,
in year two,
it was great. She did. When, as I said before, I felt like the whole crew, like this was not amateur hour when it came to being in a parade. That's what I really loved about being the experience. Because you never know, you know, when work is like, yeah, come out to the parade. You're like, okay, I'll come out. But I don't want to be the people who are like, God, that last float was great. Now here, what do we got here? A bunch of people walking. You're like, oh, all right. Well,
I mean, yeah, because we all had matching shirts. I mean, we were all coordinated. I mean, I've done this parade a few other times with other various organizations.
Right. You don't want to be just the person walking who's kind of half waving.
Yeah,
like,
this is...
But
top-notch job.
It was top-notch job all the way around. Great float, great party.